You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Eric Bonds. Eric Bonds is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. He studies and writes about the oftentimes overlapping fields of human rights, war, militarism, and the environment. His work has appeared in Z Magazine, Foreign Policy in Focus, and numerous academic venues. Eric Bonds, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very glad to, and I want to talk about the overlap between the environment and the military, which is not talked about enough, and certainly in terms of activism, it's two completely different movements without enough overlap. You wrote an article recently in Foreign Policy in Focus called "The Pentagon Comes Up Short on Climate." What was that about?
Absolutely. So right, thinking about that overlap, that concerned about the environmental crisis we face, just that in so many ways that we look at it, we can see that humanity is facing a major environmental problem in terms of ocean acidification, biodiversity loss, the depletion of resources, and global warming. And I'm concerned about war and militarism because these are things that directly contribute to environmental degradation, but then there are also huge resource sinks and just waste of resources that we could use to otherwise create greener infrastructures and create more sustainable kinds of societies. So that's kind of what motivated my thinking in this foreign policy and focus piece about the climate, or the Pentagon gets it wrong on climate, because there have been a lot of reports coming from the Department of Defense and the Pentagon and its various branches in the military saying that global warming is a major national security threat. And so on one hand, that's really heartening, and I think that sometimes environmentalists sort of cheer these kinds of reports because it says, look, to folks that deny the reality of climate change, look, even the military is taking this seriously, and so you better take it seriously too. And so on one side, that's kind of helpful, but I also worry about that kind of phrasing to call climate change a national security threat, because it's using this kind of militarized worldview that isn't really looking at the roots of the problem. And in fact, when you look at these various reports, which I did, coming from the DOD and various branches in the military, they're talking about threats that they associate with climate change, but they're never actually talking about reducing carbon emissions, which is what's driving the problem in the first place. Instead, they're really talking about, okay, we're going to be living in a more dangerous future. How do we continue to project U.S. power in, given all of the problems associated with global warming? And so what I think would be a much more beneficial response to say, let's reduce this threat by reducing carbon emissions. And a major way that we could do that would be to heavily invest in public infrastructures, in mass transit, in recreating more sustainable kinds of communities and energy efficiency. And this will, in order to do this, will require some investment from our government into our public infrastructures. And a big chunk of money really could come from the money that we spend on militarism right now.
One of the things that I notice about the Pentagon's way of talking about the climate as well is that it talks about climate disasters and climate destruction producing war, as if that were some sort of law of physics, that you have a climate crisis, therefore you have a war. And there are environmentalists who talk this way too. They say that climate change will create wars, as if this is a stronger argument for addressing climate change. But it seems to me that climate change and other disasters and conflicts will produce war only in societies that accept war and use war as a tool for addressing conflicts. I mean, aren't we sort of being persuaded that war is the inevitable result of of crises, and not just war, but U.S. foreign wars thousands of miles away are somehow the inevitable product of climate change.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and this is something that's worrisome to me. We can see this even in how people are talking about, for instance, this terrible war in Syria, and some folks have pointed, this is an outcome of climate change, or we can link this to climate change. I think that that's hugely problematic for so many different reasons. And there's also a real implicit kind of racism, I think, that's associated with this, or, kind of a colonialism sort of attitude that says that when poor people or people in the global south are faced with environmental change, when they're faced with environmental problems, then they sort of automatically or they naturally resort to weapons and to killing one another, whereas the assumption is that more civilized people supposedly in the global north, when we're faced with a climate crisis or environmental problems, that we respond to this in a more rational way, and that's just just factually wrong. That's just incorrect. But I agree that it comes with an implicit, I guess, ideological message, though, that sort of says that we should really be preparing for more hostilities and more war in the future because of climate change. And that's absolutely not a helpful kind of response, I think.
Yeah, makes it worse. The another point that you make in your article about the Pentagon's misguided viewing of climate change is that it seems like much of the U.S. government and much of the United Nations to be planning for how to mitigate the damage and live better with the changes that the climate disaster is bringing, rather than working to prevent it. Isn't that the emphasis that you see in the Pentagon's reports on climate change, for example, that there is all sorts of effort being put into how to survive, how to live with the damage of climate change, rather than how to prevent its worsening in the first place?
Absolutely. That is the focus, is recognizing that this is a reality, and to some degree that is true, because we've already put a lot of carbon emissions into the atmosphere, and so a certain amount of climate change is just locked in no matter what we do right now. So to a certain degree, that's true. But it does seem that the assumption is that societies won't really get a grip on climate change, won't really begin to aggressively reduce carbon emissions, and so we should expect this more kind of catastrophic future ahead of us. And that is not a foregone conclusion, that's really a political decision that's being made by powerful people, including people within our own government. And so I really worry about that too. And it's not just that they are planning for climate change and for unmitigated climate change, but they're planning for it in this particular way, to think about how can we continue to exert U.S. power, and how can we continue to be a dominant military force in this changing world.
Yeah, and find more resources in the Arctic as the ice melts from the destruction of climate change that will be further worsened by those resources, the fossil fuels pulled out of the... I mean, it's absolutely backwards thinking in terms of addressing the problem.
Right.
You cite a figure in your article, 4% of what is spent just on the Pentagon budget is what the U.S. spends currently on trying to cut carbon emissions. I mean, in a sense, you would like to see, you would like to see climate change treated as a threat in the way that military opponents are treated as a threat. I would love to see France taking an all on board, no holds barred, enthusiastic, massive investment in pitiless addressing of climate change, war on climate change without pity and mercy. Instead, we just have these sort of halfway token efforts on climate change, while the massive investment in war continues.
Right, absolutely. And the U.S. military budget is just so big. It's just, it's mind-boggling. It literally is so hard to get a handle on how big that budget actually is. But Miriam Pemberton at the Institute for Policy Studies does a great report every few years, and she just did one in 2014 last year called Climate versus Combat. And that's where that figure about the 4% of U.S. spending on energy efficiency and emissions reductions and renewable energy in comparison to U.S. spending on the military. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Miriam has been a guest here. She's a good resource.
Absolutely right. So I would really encourage people to go and check out that report. And she has some great figures that kind of narrow that down a little bit, just to say that if the U.S. government, for instance, chose to forego four littoral combat ships, that we could use that money instead to double the Department of Energy's spending on renewable energy and energy efficiency. Just by that one choice,
yeah,
we'll go
four ships.
The Pentagon says we don't need.
Yeah, incredible. The Pentagon does talk occasionally about, you know, efforts to green the military in very slight ways, but it is, by the figures I've seen, the top single consumer of petroleum and would rank number 30-something in a list of nations if it were a nation in terms of petroleum consumption. Does that sound right to you in terms of the...
Absolutely, yeah. Uh-huh. Right. When we think about it, it's global footprint with bases, you know, all around the globe. And when we think about these, you know, huge kinds of machinery that they're operating, it's so resource intensive, so energy intensive. Absolutely. So they're a major user of fossil fuels. Absolutely.
It seems very symbolic as well as substantive in its significance to me that they're canceling protests in Paris, France, around the climate talks, in order to focus on escalating a war and the fear and the scaling back of civil liberties around militarization of France. It seems that the two are quite opposed in this way. We can't work on protecting the environment because we're too busy working on war, just as we can't spend the money on the environment because it's all got to go to war. We're speaking with Eric Bonds, who is an associate professor of sociology at Mary Washington University here in Virginia, where I am as well. There's another great article that you wrote, Eric, called The Wastes of War in Iraq and Afghanistan. This was in Z Magazine. Can you talk about the particular types of environmental destruction you looked at in those wars beyond just the burning of gasoline?
Right, absolutely. That wars are inherently destructive to the environment, but there's this, you know, one particular kind of environmental degradation that's been getting a little bit more attention in terms of the U.S. military's waste disposal practices in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that the majority of waste that the DOD produced in those countries during the occupations were burned in open pits or trenches, just out in the open air, including, you know, all kinds of highly processed industrial kinds of materials that we all know are not healthy things to burn, lots of plastic, lots of styrofoam and other kinds of packaging materials, even solvents and other kinds of chemicals. There were some reports that even body parts were included in these. This is something that's gotten attention from amputations and things like that. So just all of the waste that was being produced at many bases was just thrown into these burn pits, producing all kinds of hazardous emissions. And we all know that burning trash in the backyard is not good. We can go to the EPA's website, and it'll tell us not to do this, that this is associated with all kinds of known toxins, including dioxin, which is one of the most toxic substances, really, that we know about. So on one hand, we know this information, but, yeah, this is exactly how the U.S. military was disposing of its waste. And so it shouldn't have been too surprising that veterans came back from Iraq and Afghanistan and reported being very sick, having respiratory problems, having immune deficiency kinds of problems, experiencing chronic fatigue, development of tumors, and things like that. And it was through this process where veterans were talking to one another, sharing their experiences, when they were able to realize that they, had a kind of a common environmental exposure to these toxic fumes from the burn pits, and they, you know, have developed a movement to try to secure some compensation and some justice for being exposed to these toxins. And so that's really what my research looks at, is a kind of media response, and it's very important that the media has begun to cover how veterans have been harmed by this pollution. But I also have noticed this really troubling thing, in that the U.S. media, just looking at mainstream newspapers, but also we could look at television network reports, just really largely ignores any kind of potential civilian impacts.
And this was, I think you said, about 10 pounds of waste per troop at bases in Iraq and Afghanistan. Is that right?
That's right, exactly.
So this is
the vast majority of which was put into these open pit burns.
So
just to give a sense, you know, I mean, we're thinking about, let's say, a place in Iraq where in the summertime it would be very hot, and so people would need to be drinking a lot of water. Most of that's coming from water bottles. And so in a place like the Balad base that had 22,000 service members at its peak, all of the water bottles that those people are drinking are just going right into an open pit burn. So they're literally burning tens of thousands of water bottles every single day, along with a lot of other hazards.
Toxic plastic made from the stuff they're there to fight the war for, bringing their consumptive U.S. lifestyle there, and the military's lack of concern for their health along with it, and burning that stuff in the air. What about the damage to Iraqis and Afghans as well?
Right, and that's largely the unknown, and that's just not even been part of the conversation so far, which is why I'm so happy to be on the show to have a chance to talk about it. And that one thing that I did in my research, beyond just doing this kind of analysis of U.S. media reporting and noting how civilians have been totally left out of the picture, was just to look at bases where I could find out that there was some kind of long-term open burn pit, and then just to use Google Earth and the satellite images there, then to look at what's around it. And we can see in many bases, you know, these are populated areas around the bases, that sometimes we have this imagery in the United States of Iraq and Afghanistan of being uninhabited desert spaces, but that's not at all the case around many places where there were U.S. bases. So the Balad base, for instance, was one of the largest U.S. bases, and if you look at it on Google Earth, you'll see that it has the cultivation all around it, has agriculture all around it. It's less than a mile from the Tigris River. There are, you know, little townships and houses all around it. So absolutely, if veterans were being exposed to this pollution and made sick, which, you know, I very much believe is true, it really stands to reason, though, that Iraqis and in Afghans would be similarly harmed.
You have to imagine so. I mean, I've spoken with Iraqi doctors who've done studies, but most of them in cities that were attacked, like Fallujah, and they're attributing a lot of the epidemics that they see to things like depleted uranium weapons, and not necessarily to open-air burns at U.S. bases. Have there not been any comprehensive studies or major studies in Iraq or by the U.S. military of this problem?
You know, there have been some studies, but it's difficult to trace, I guess, to trace the causality. But certainly there have been studies that have documented, you know, certain kinds of heavy metals in Iraqi children and showing that that's highly associated with birth defects, for instance. But you're absolutely right in that there were a number of environmental harms happening in Iraq, for instance. And so a lot of these things, they interact, and it's not just one thing that might be affecting environmental health and public health in Iraq. These things can kind of combine and have even more deleterious kinds of impacts.
But you did find quite a few, you know, published newspaper stories about U.S. war veterans, particular individual experiences. What have those stories looked like, and what has been the response to the demands of veterans from the Department of So-Called Defense and the Veterans Administration?
Right. I found 49 studies that in just major U.S. newspapers, and you know, almost across the board, there was not even a mention of civilians. There were a few, I think maybe five, that had one sentence just that just might have mentioned civilians. And there was one story, and it was covering basically a peace movement that was talking about the environmental impacts of the war in Iraq and included the issue of burn pits. So almost across the board, there was really no mention, hardly any mention of civilians. I'm sorry, what was the other part of your question that you asked?
I'm not sure. I think that was helpful, but I'm wondering.
The response of the government. I'm sorry.
Sure.
That you know, veterans have been able to come together and have been able to find supporters in Congress in order to at least achieve some kind of recognition. And so one thing that happened in 2013 is that the U.S. Congress passed a so-called burn pit registry where veterans who feel like they might have been exposed to burn pit emissions or who might be, you know, feeling that they've been harmed in some way can go to a VA website, and they can go and basically enter their names and enter their experiences and any medical conditions and things like that. And the idea is that this should provide some means to study and to prove that there is or could be a link between this kind of environmental exposure and negative health outcomes. And so that's really, you know, I think that one kind of response from our U.S. government. But the U.S. government really has been hesitant to acknowledge harm, and it has been making steps to acknowledge harm, but it still is doing so in a way that is trying to deflect responsibility, trying to deflect blame by saying, well, sure, some people might have been made sick, but we can't really know because it's so complicated and there's so many other kinds of environmental factors that could make a veteran sick. So on one hand, the U.S. government is trying to dissuade veterans from filing claims and from, you know, associated environmental exposures from their illnesses. On the other hand, there is a kind of recognition, but for Iraqi civilians or Afghans who might have been living near U.S. bases and burn pits, you know, there's really been no U.S. government response.
Yeah. You brought up, I think, the comparison with Agent Orange on perhaps a larger scale in the case of Agent Orange. But what are the similarities? I mean, this is a case that is still crying out for justice half a century later, and is of course affecting children and grandchildren. Are there any instances of the possibility of illnesses from the burns being passed down to children?
Right, absolutely. With something like exposure to dioxin, that this isn't just something that affects one generation. That this is something that can have genetic impacts that can be passed down to subsequent generations. And you know, that's true too if something like dioxin gets into a food chain too. That it can be digested, or ingested, even in future generations, and to continue to cause harms. So for certain, that's a real concern. And I should say, too, that I was sort of noticing in looking at the media coverage of this story that veterans themselves were sort of talking about this, making this analogy that there's a comparison here with Agent Orange. And I think that comes from this experience of being a veteran and being most likely a young person, a person that, you know, was very healthy, and when going to war and then coming back, you know, really sick and not being able to explain that. And that's very much the kind of experience that Vietnam veterans had, but also the experience of doctors saying, you know, it's all in your head, or we can't explain it, we don't know what's going on. So those are the kinds of similarities, I think, that veterans were experiencing in saying that we need to avoid that kind of response again, that the medical establishment, the U.S. government, better do a better job of taking these kinds of claims more seriously to begin with. What I see is another troubling analogy is exactly the one that you mentioned, in that eventually the U.S. government did award compensation and some medical care to veterans who were harmed by Agent Orange, although it was way too little and way too late. But, you know, other than cleaning up one especially polluted place, the U.S. government has never compensated the people in Vietnam for spraying Agent Orange and other dioxin-laced herbicides across their landscapes. And so I'm afraid that we're on that same kind of track, too, which I think we need to acknowledge the harm done to veterans, but at the same time we need to acknowledge the harm done to civilians and work to provide health care and compensation to both groups.
Yeah, we've got war being extended over there rather than compensation or restitution
right.
at this point.
Right.
You know, we often think about war as happening so far away and these things being rather hard to study and mysterious because they're thousands of miles away. But back in January of this year, I had a guest on this program named Brian Salvatore from Louisiana, who was busy actively trying to prevent a huge open-air burning by the U.S. military of explosives in Louisiana near a poor African-American neighborhood, surprisingly enough. There seemed to be no connection there with the peace movement or veterans. It seemed to be a local and environmental effort to prevent this open-air burning. But do you think there should be more of a focus on trying to get careful study of the results when these things are done in the United States, where they can be observed by U.S. academics.
Right, absolutely. And just along with recognition that war causes environmental degradation across the board, and so absolutely during war and in the aftermath of war, and you know, in the context of the U.S. overseas, but also just the everyday ongoing preparation for war is horribly environmentally destructive because you know, producing weapons requires all of this toxic materials, and so it you know creates a legacy of environmental pollution. The Department of Defense owns, for instance, manages 140 separate Superfund sites. But then also, in, you know, when weapon systems are outmoded or retired, then you have all of these toxic hazards that you have to deal with. And so that's something that the DOD constantly faces. What do we do with all these old weapons? And one of the responses has been to burn them or to explode them out in the open, you know, again, creating more environmental hazards. So I think just starting with that recognition of that across the board, war is bad for the environment would be one good place to start.
Well, and your bringing of these two issues together is a very good start, and I hope the activist movements follow suit and join together more often and in a more lasting way. Eric Bonds is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. We will have links to him and his articles at talknationradio.org. Eric, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersnap.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, there are calls for the resignation of Chicago Mayor and former Obama Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, stemming from the city's 13-month cover-up of video that belied the official story of the police killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. That video, along with an autopsy, which also showed police's initial story to be false, eventually came to light through the work of journalists. But not mainstream journalists. It was independent reporters, including our guest, who stepped in to force the police department and the city to acknowledge not only what happened the night of October 20th, 2014, how Officer Jason Van Dyke put 16 bullets into the body of a boy who posed him no harm, but what happened after, as institutional forces came together to keep the truth from the public. The story of Laquan McDonald is still ongoing. Counterspin spoke with writer and activist Jamie Calvin. He's reported on the Chicago Police Department for years. He unearthed McDonald's autopsy and has continued to pursue the story. That interview is coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at the week's press. Some would say Columbia Journalism Review put it mildly, referring to events of December 4th as an unbecoming media frenzy in San Bernardino. They're referring to the sight of dozens of TV crew members from MSNBC and CNN trampling through the home of alleged killers Syed Farouk and Tashfeen Malik, rifling through whatever they came across, holding it up for the camera and guessing about its meaning. Sample commentary from MSNBC's Carrie Sanders, quote, "Come over here. You can see the baby's toys. We have really quite a number of toys," close quote. Sanders proceeded to show millions of viewers various photographs, we don't know of whom, and for good measure, the driver's license of Farouk's mother, including identifying information like her address. We're told the landlord assured that the police had released the scene, and the networks and their defenders, like Slate Magazine, which called it great TV, tell us that poking around is what reporters do, though MSNBC apologized for showing identifying information. That misses the point that even if no laws were broken, this was not a news event. It shed no light on the December 2nd attack. It was just, in CJR's words, quote, "a frantic race to beat opponents and grab attention," close quote. To say you see no difference between that sort of media pile-on and actual good journalism is a sorry admission indeed. Well, disheartening as it was, that spectacle was far from the lowest point of what Alternet's Stephen Rosenfeld described as the bottomless season of nastiness, racist hate-mongering, and war fever that swept through much of the media and political sphere in the wake of the San Bernardino massacre. Not that it started there. As we see journalists entertain calls to ban all Muslims from the country, and local politicians like Nevada's Michelle Fiore saying they'd like to personally shoot Syrian refugees in the head, it's easy to despair and to forget that it isn't actually news media's job to simply amplify such frightening rhetoric. One thing journalists can do, besides show editorial outrage in the face of ignorant fear-mongering, as many are, is to ask cui bono, who benefits from tragic events like those in San Bernardino, or before that in Colorado Springs? Li Fang explores one of the answers in a piece for The Intercept. Fang's review of investor transcripts for gun companies, ammunition manufacturers, and sporting stores turned up numerous instances of executives discussing mass shooting incidents as lucrative because they stirred calls for gun control, which the National Rifle Association and other advocates predictably attack and use to stoke panic buying, which leads to profits. It makes sense, of course, but it's still chilling to read the head of Dick's Sporting Goods, for example, comment that the murders of 20 children and 6 adults in Newtown, Connecticut, very much accelerated gun business, not by spurring sales among hunters, but by bringing, quote, "shooters into the industry," close quote. Another retailer notes that because his company, quote, didn't blink as others did to stop selling AR-15 platform guns, close quote, after the Newtown killings there, quote, business went vertical. I mean, it just went crazy, close quote. Gun control is a legislative, political, and public health issue. Getting at what powerful actors are doing and why is harder than picking through baby toys on TV. It's also more worthwhile. And finally, as economist Dean Baker notes, the Washington Post has long expressed outrage over the fact that unionized auto workers can get $28 an hour. So it's not a surprise to see editorial page writer Charles Lane's December 2nd column complaining that the United Auto Workers ships jobs abroad. Surprising, no, but depressing, yes, because Lane's argument is that if the union would just agree to lower pay for its workers, then auto manufacturers might maybe shift fewer jobs to Mexico. Lane notes that even non-union car manufacturers are shifting jobs to other countries because moving work to where there are cheaper wages is a thing companies do. But if they didn't have to deal with a union, he says, they would have had an option to pay workers, sure, less than unionized workers make, but maybe somewhere more than Mexican workers make. An option that they would take because, well, Lane doesn't explain. It's not protectionism per se that rankles the Post. Baker notes that they have yet to run an op-ed complaining about rules that allow U.S. doctors to earn on average twice as much as their counterparts in other wealthy countries, a rule that costs the country nearly $100 billion a year in higher health care costs. And if it were high manufacturing wages in general that were the issue, the Post would have to note that manufacturing compensation is on average more than 30% higher in Germany and several other European countries than in the United States. Lane says his problem is that a, quote, lucky handful of union members get paid well to the exclusion of other American workers, close quote. But if he were actually intrigued by the relationship between unions and inequality, he might note the IMF research that says that unions are associated with lower levels of inequality, not higher. So, barring all that, Lane and the Post would seem to just be instantiating elite media 101. Pit workers against workers, and encourage anyone struggling to locate the source of their problems by looking down or sideways, but never up. And a correction. On last week's show, I said that Paris erected a plaque in 2011 dedicated to those killed in the Algerian massacre of 1961. That plaque actually went up in 2001. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. At times when media or politicians talk about video, like that of a Chicago police officer killing a 17-year-old, as inciting public unrest, you'd think they believe that it's not the horrific action shown, its context and implication, that inflamed, but simply the video itself. It's as if when it comes to police violence against mostly poor, mostly people of color, some believe things would go easier if we just didn't know. That's a luxury, of course, and affected community members don't actually need more proof of their experience. But for journalists, we would hope that it's better to know would be a core principle. The case of Officer Jason Van Dyke and Laquan McDonald has led to public protest. An unprecedented charge of first-degree murder for an on-duty Chicago officer, and the resignation so far, as we tape on December 2nd, of Chicago Police Chief Gary McCarthy. Is the depth of media coverage appropriate for a story that's about much more than a single killing? Our next guest has been involved in the case for some time now. Jamie Calvin is a writer and human rights activist working with the group Invisible Institute. He joins us now by phone from Chicago. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jamie Calvin.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, the Chicago Tribune ran an excited editorial last week demanding to know Why did it take 13 months to charge Van Dyke with a crime when authorities had the video and an autopsy in days? Who was responsible for the initial false narrative that McDonald was lunging at Van Dyke with a knife? And what's up with the missing surveillance video from the nearby Burger King? These are all appropriate questions for November 27th, 2015, you know, but take us back, if you would, to October of 2014, when Jason Van Dyke killed Laquan McDonald. What can you say about media coverage at the time?
I think it's a really important question. It hasn't been talked about enough. The media is part of the same machinery as the police department's false narrative about individual instances like the Laquan McDonald case and larger macro narrative about the state of the city. And so, you know, part of what is, I think, getting lost right now, and understandably given the extreme and egregious nature of what I think can only be called the execution of Laquan McDonald, is that this is not a huge departure from the norm. I mean, this is the norm. So on October 20th of last year, the police-involved shooting, so-called, of a black teenager on the Southwest Side was treated by the media on the basis of information solely provided by the police department and a spokesperson for the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union, as, you know, a kind of routine story of officer self-defense. Young man with a knife lunges at officer, is shot in the chest, dies sometime later. Completely uncritical response. A police shooting, almost invariably, about 80-85% of the time, of an African American. That's a story that recurs between 40 and 50 times a year in Chicago. We as journalists do not, unless there are exceptional circumstances, dig into the story to, you know, do the hard work on the scene, in the neighborhood, to find out what happened. To this day, even in this post-Ferguson era, the tendency is just to publish the police blotter. I don't want to exclude myself from that indictment of the press. I was brought to this story not by my own hunch or insight or intuition about what had happened here, but by a whistleblower who reached out to a colleague of mine, Craig Futterman, a civil rights lawyer, and myself, with a tip a couple of weeks after the shooting to the effect that the facts were sharply at variance with the official account, that there was video. And he was in a position close enough to the investigation to say that he was concerned that this was not going to be vigorously investigated.
Well, walk us through some of the journalistic work involved here.
Among the things that the whistleblower provided was enough information that I was able to track down a civilian witness to the shooting. He was not happy to have me appear on his doorstep. He was really worried about the possibility of police retaliation. And he told me then, ultimately in great detail, and he was extremely credible, what he saw. He was a motorist. His passage had been blocked by this unfolding event. He had had an unobstructed view of the shooting. He gave a really vivid and powerful account that ultimately completely aligns with the video we've now seen. I've spoken with another witness as well. You know, and these are grown men and formidable individuals who, because of what they'd seen, to witness the execution of a young man by the police in the course of their day was such a break with reality, you know, such a break with the expectations about reality, that they came away feeling like anything's possible. Right. You know, if the state can do this, anything's possible. So the fear in the witnesses was one of the really striking, and it continues to this day, really striking things about it. I was able to learn through a high official in Cook County who reached out on my behalf to the medical examiner. I was able to learn in January the content of the autopsy. Autopsies take several months before they are subject to Freedom of Information Act, you know, are finalized and can be FOIA'd. And so I knew in advance of being able to get the document what it would contain. And then when I got it, I was able to publish a detailed account, which I published in Slate. And this was, you know, so radically inconsistent with the police account that Laquan McDonald had been shot 16 times and the bullets had entered front and back. So that was the next kind of pivotal point. You know, there are a couple of frames around this story. Everybody's asked, how can the city wait so long and hold this information back? And it's important to recognize that everything we know now was known by the police department and at the highest levels of the city within hours of the shooting.
Right.
They had both police and civilian witnesses. They had the videotape. The autopsy was performed the next morning. You know, they had all this information. They were also operating, it seems clear now, within two broad frames. One was autumn 2014. Ferguson is, you know, in virtual uprising. The mayor and the police superintendent of a city like Chicago, what's the worst possible thing that could happen?
Right.
You know, it would be outrageous and utterly unjustified fatal shooting of a black teenager by a police officer. The other broad context and frame was the mayor was running for re-election.
Right.
So at various points, I think decisions were made. I don't know precisely what they were, but in relation to this, you know, we have to get through the election cycle while containing this case. In the 48 hours before I published about the autopsy in Slate, I tried to get a comment from the department. I called the news office repeatedly. I, you know, sent emails. The news guy had always just left his desk. He was going to call me back. And I never heard. I couldn't even get a no comment.
Right.
The piece in Slate appeared at 8-something at night, beyond the end of the workday. The FOIA that my colleague submitted revealed that within, I think, 12 or 13 minutes after it was posted, the full text of the article was in the email box of the mayor's entire senior staff. So they were hyper, hyper vigilant about anything written about this case.
Okay.
Then the other critical point in the narrative is in late February, lawyers representing the family of Laquan McDonald, in a kind of unexpected development through the probate process, they had to establish the estate of Laquan McDonald in order to represent the family. Turns out probate provides subpoena powers.
Mm-hmm.
So they were able to subpoena the city for records related to the death of Laquan McDonald, and through that process got a copy of the video, at which point, and this is within weeks of the mayor's runoff election, with the video in hand, not yet having actually filed a lawsuit. You know, they were preparing a wrongful death suit, but they hadn't yet filed. They reached out to the city law department, said, we have to talk. And fairly quickly, we were able to negotiate a $5 million settlement, you know, for the benefit of the family, but conditioned on not releasing the video. A lot of different things have entered into, you know, Ferguson concerns, the mayor's reelection, but also I think just the culture of how the police department responds. And I've said this repeatedly in recent weeks, that what's really striking, if you look at just all the different acts, including officers at the scene and then how the investigative process was handled, at every stage and at every level of the police department and the city, in response to this utterly appalling incident, the impulse, the default, just the cultural reflex was to circle the wagons and to double down on what they absolutely had to know was a false narrative. So, you know, there's a lot of talk in Chicago now about conspiracy and cover-up, and I think those words have their place, but I think they're also misleading. And I think what we're confronting is something in some ways more disturbing, which is the culture. You know, we talk about the code of silence, which is one of those really resonant phrases, and it's very evocative because there is, in fact, a kind of coerced silence of police officers who witness abuses but are intimidated into silence by fear of retaliation. And I think there's also silence of victims who know they won't be believed and won't be taken seriously. So the term makes some sense, but there's another sense in which it's really inapt, because what something like Laquan McDonald incident reflects, and I think it's an instance of a much, much broader phenomena, is an absolute fierce effort to maintain narrative control.
Right.
So the code of silence is a tool in the service of narrative control. And to come back to the press, that I think is where we have not been as effective as we might be in penetrating and piercing that dynamic. And it's critical to do so. I mean, how many other Laquan McDonalds are there?
Exactly. Well, I would say that, you know, we have to talk about extending that culture to include media as well. It's very interesting to see, well, first of all, to hear that, you know, within minutes of your Slate piece on the autopsy going up, the mayoral administration was on it. And yet, even though it really did contradict the narrative, it didn't lead to the change in media coverage that the video subsequently did, although the autopsy itself was a very graphic depiction of the fact that the initial story that police had told was not true, could not be true. And yet somehow it didn't lead to what we're seeing now, you know, which is not to degrade or to denigrate what we're seeing now. But let me ask you about that, because in this Tribune editorial, they say basically, let's hear it for whistleblowers and for FOIA. You know, they say if not for a whistleblower, this all might have ended with the CYA narrative, the cover your ass narrative supplied by the police. And they demand, so who's going to get to the bottom of this? You know, and there's never a call out of reporters themselves.
Right.
But whistleblowers need someone to get the story out, right? And FOIA is not useful unless someone actually uses it.
I found witnesses. I found civilian witnesses who have played a significant role in this and in the, you know, have been to the grand jury and, you know, will figure downstream in prosecutions. Why am I uniquely doing that? I mean, I just don't, you know, so there's also just a kind of reporting that involves being on the street, cultivating relationships, having sources in the neighborhood that you can assess in terms of credibility, that has almost completely, to the extent it ever existed, and I can only speak for Chicago, it's almost completely atrophied. And I think it's partly the debilitated establishment media in terms of the economic crisis in journalism. But I don't think that's a sufficient explanation. I think it also is a question of core values and priorities. Journalism has a lot to answer in this. And for all of the righteous indignation of this moment, which I, again, I don't want to sound dismissive of, virtually none of it, apart from this conversation and a couple of blog posts I've seen, has been directed at the role of journalism as part of how we go about, you know, thinking back to your opening, how we go about not knowing things that we're capable of knowing about fundamental human rights issues.
What would you say about reporting going forward? I mean, we have evidence not just of an institutional climate in the police department that lets a police officer think they can do this, but we have a cover-up that extends at least to other levels. We've had a year of false narrative. So what should reporting going forward do to be appropriate to the issues at stake here?
Well, I think there's sort of two dimensions of an answer there. One is collectively, and part of this is legal process, part of it's journalistic, you know, the mayor's now created a task force to look at police accountability issues. I mean, there are a number of different venues for this, but I think it's just critical to, in the most minute detail, learn everything that can be learned from the negative example of what happened and how the police department of the city responded in the Laquan McDonald incident. This is a wretched, infinitely regrettable, tragic incident. It also, at this juncture, is a really precious public resource. Mm-hmm. And we need to make sure that we're not just blaming and media speculation about who's going to get fired next. I think really looking at building the true narrative of what happened, you know, that's one thing. I think the other is, I mean, I'm a great champion of FOIA, and the last time we talked was about a lawsuit I was the plaintiff in that resulted in a ruling that police misconduct files are public. And since we've talked, you know, we've published a database with all that information on it. If people are interested, the title is the Citizens Police Data Project. So I don't want to minimize the central importance of FOIA, but there's a tremendous amount of information that bears on these issues that you can only find on the ground in the neighborhoods most affected by these patterns of abuse and also a kind of abandonment. And that's the sort of reporting that I am personally deeply committed to. There are so many things that can be learned only by immersing yourself in these human situations. and especially to go back to your theme of sort of denial and not knowing. I mean, we have in this society around issues of race an extraordinary ability to know things and not know things at the same time. It's just really extraordinary. And I think journalists have a critical role in sort of disabling that kind of knowing and not knowing, that those strategies of denial. Part of that is the fundamental difficulty and intractability of some of these issues. And so if you don't feel like you can be effective in relation to them, it's hard to dwell on them. But I think journalism has a lot to answer for. I mean, I think we aid and abet people's strategies of denial to a significant degree. And the only way I know of moving against that is really to immerse oneself as a journalist in those human situations.
We've been speaking with Jamie Calvin. You can find the work of Invisible Institute online at invisibleinstitute.com. Thank you so much, Jamie Calvin, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that's Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The website is also the place to sign up for FAIR's email network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I have lots for you in this program. We'll hear two reports direct from Paris, plus an interview on the best and maybe the only way to really save the future. But first, I want you to hear 10 minutes from the former NASA scientist who warned us all about climate change back in 1988. Here is Dr. James Hansen speaking December 2nd at a press conference at COP21, the big climate summit in Paris.
The problem is that fossil fuels appear to the consumer to be the cheapest energy. They're not really cheapest because they don't include their full cost to society. They're partially subsidized, but mainly they don't include the effects of air pollution and water pollution on human health. If your child gets asthma, you have to pay the bill. The fossil fuel company doesn't. And the climate effects, which are beginning to be significant and will be much larger in the future, are also not included in the price of the fossil fuels. So the solution would be fairly straightforward. Let's add into the price of fossil fuels the total cost, which you can't do suddenly, but you can do it gradually over time so that people have time to adjust. So I argue that this should be done, it has to be across the board, across all fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, at the source, the domestic mine or the port of entry. And I also argue that that money should be given to the public, given equal amount to all legal residents of the country. That way the person who does better than average in limiting their carbon footprint will actually make money. And in fact, 2/3 of the people would come out ahead. And it would also address the growing income inequality in the world, which is occurring in almost all countries, because the low-income people would tend to have a lower carbon footprint. People who fly around the world and have big houses would pay more, but they can afford to do that. So that's a transparent, market-based solution, a conservative solution, which stimulates the economy. The economic studies in the United States show that after 10 years, if you added $10 a ton of CO2 carbon fee, distributed the money to the public, after 10 years, it would reduce emissions 30%, and after 20 years, more than 50%. And it would spur the economy, creating more than 3 million new jobs. Furthermore, this is the only viable international approach. You cannot ask each of 190 countries to individually limit their emissions. What we have to do is have the price of fossil fuels honest. That requires only a few of the major players to agree, let's have a rising carbon fee. And those countries that don't want to have that fee will put a border duty on products from those countries. And furthermore, we will rebate to our manufacturers the carbon fee when they export a product to a non-participating nation. So this, economists agree, is a fair way to do it, and it could rapidly move us off of fossil fuels. But what we are hearing is, although Christiana Figueres says many have said we need a carbon price, and investment would be so much easier with a carbon price, but life is much more complex than that. So what we're talking about instead is the same old thing, that was tried in Kyoto. Asking each country to promise, I'll reduce my emissions, I will cap my emissions, I'll reduce them 20% or whatever they decide is they can do. You know, in science, when you do a well-controlled experiment and get a well-documented result, you expect that if you do the experiment again, you're going to get the same result. So why are we talking about doing the same thing again? I don't like to be use crude language, but I learned this from my mother, so I'll use it anyway. This is half-assed, and it's half-baked. It's half-assed because there's no way to make it global. You have to beg each nation. So I went to Germany to speak with, I was hoping to speak to Merkel, but I got cut off at Sigmar Gabriel, the minister. I said, well, he said, oh, we're going to do cap and trade with offsets. And I said, that won't work. We've tried that. And so I said, what's the cap on India? And he said, we'll tighten our carbon cap. Well, Germany's now 2% of the world emissions. So him tightening the German carbon cap is not going to solve the problem. You've got to have something that will work globally. And it's half-baked because there's no enforcement mechanism. You know, what I hear is all the ministers are coming here, or the heads of state, and they're planning to clap each other on the back and say, oh, we're really doing great. This is a very successful conference, and we're going to address the climate problem. Well, if that's what happens, then we're screwing the next generation and the following ones, because we're being stupid in doing the same thing again that we did, 18 years ago? Yeah, so what's the effect of, you know, you try very hard and you say, okay, we're going to reduce our nation's emissions. Well, or an individual reduces their emissions. The one effect of that is to reduce the demand for the product and keep the price low. As long as fossil fuels are dirt cheap, they will keep being used. It's like burning coal is like burning dirt. You just take a bulldozer and you can bulldoze it out of the ground. It's very cheap, but it does not include its cost to society. It's a very dirty fuel with some negative effects, which we now understand very well. We can't pretend that we don't know what's going to happen if we stay on this path. So this is the path we're on, you know. To pretend that what we're doing is having any effect, you know, it might slow down the rate of growth, but that's not what's needed. Science tells us we have to actually reduce emissions rapidly. And furthermore, the economic studies show that if you put an honest price on carbon emissions, you would reduce emissions rapidly. But if you don't have that price on there, you're not going to reduce the emissions. You will reduce the emissions someplace, but then it keeps the price low, so somebody else will burn it.
And that economic study you're referring to also found that if you put $10 per ton and increase it $10 per ton over 10 years, what was the effect in jobs?
Well, in the case of the United States economy, that's where the study was done in detail. It was 3 million new jobs in 10 years and significant increase in GNP. So we need energy. But people thinking, oh, we have to do less. Well, yeah, we should have energy efficiency, but that would be encouraged by a rising price. But we do need energy. We need energy to raise the poor people out of poverty. That's the best way to keep population under control. Those countries that have become wealthy now have fertility rates that are below the replenishment level. So we need, and the reason these countries became wealthy is because they had energy, and that energy was fossil fuels. Unfortunately, we can't continue to use that as the mechanism to get out of poverty. We need to have clean energies, and the way to make that happen is to have this. I've met with captains of industry, I call them, leaders of not only utilities but even oil companies. These people have children and grandchildren. They would like to be part of the solution. If the government would give them the right incentive by putting this across-the-board rising carbon fee, they say they would change their investments and they could do it rapidly. So it's not that the problem can't be solved, but it's not being solved. And nothing that I've heard so far indicates that we're intending to It's not too complex. It's the simplest approach you could have.
It's
just
not
have
rocket
an
science.
Honest, simple rising carbon fee.
That was Dr. James Hansen speaking in Paris on December 2nd at the COP21 briefing. Next up, Lindsay Allen, the Executive Director of the Rainforest Action Network, or RAN, dials in from Paris. From the Rainforest Action Network, a new guest to speak to us, so we're just in the middle of the conference. Please introduce yourself to our listeners on Radio EcoShock.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me, Alex. This is Lindsay Allen from Rainforest Action Network, and I'm the Executive Director here and one of a couple delegation members that we have in Paris this week.
All right. Now, it's a very confusing situation. I understand there's at least 40,000 people there for this conference. What are some of your impressions so far?
I would say my impressions are that there are high-level talks, lots of bilateral deals, and quite a bit of activity that's happening outside of the kind of official delegate zone that's being underreported.
All right. Now, along those lines, it's pretty hard to get climate action going in a city that's kind of locked down due to the terrorist attack. How are you getting around that as an activist organization?
Well, I think there are so many folks who understand that we cannot allow our voices to be silenced at a moment where climate justice is a critical imperative for so many people around the world. And so even when I arrived on Sunday, you know, it had followed a morning opening prayer led by indigenous groups at the site of the Bataclan. It was followed by a massive display of shoes of all of the Parisians and folks from around the world, including the shoes of Ban Ki-moon and the Pope, demonstrating all of the people who would have wanted to be in the streets that day, speaking up for climate justice and climate equity. And then there was a massive human chain that stretched all along, you know, for blocks and blocks, thousands of people just stretching as a way of getting around some of the protest bans, very peacefully assembled, but giving you a taste of what the big marches could have looked like. And at the same time, even today, there was, you know, yesterday, BNP Paribas, there was a big protest outside of that bank, given that they have funneled so much money in, they're sponsoring the COP, and at the same time, they funneled so much money into coal, you know, about to the tune of 17 billion euros since, you know, the last big Copenhagen talks. And then today, there's a massive, it's being called this Climate Solutions Gathering, and it's cities and mayors that want to take action, but it's also this space for so much corporate greenwash. And dozens of protesters have been disrupting those activities throughout the day, calling attention to the fact that capitalism is not going to provide the solution. We need a change to business as usual in order to ensure climate justice. And, you know, you see buses and buses and buses of police pull up, but there is this sentiment that this is too important for us to be silenced.
Are there organizing groups of developing countries, the voices that we don't hear from, I'm not talking about Germany or America or Canada or Australia, are the other countries getting organized and getting a voice in this conference?
I would say in the official part of the conference, the voices that you expect to be dominating are, you know, and it is very much a game, like a big power game, where there's bilateral deals, there's side conversations going, groups that are under-resourced would have very little ability to influence the talk. But I think at the same time, there's this realization that, you know, what is movements have never been led by diplomats and elites and elected officials. They're led by the people who really understand what is at stake. And so at every margin of these talks, you know, there are voices from the Global South and frontline communities from North America and indigenous voices that are refusing to be silenced. And just a couple examples, Indigenous Rising, It Takes Roots to Weather the Storm. There are folks that are just taking the opportunity to disrupt spaces as a way of making sure that everyone recognizes they're there. And while they are at the forefront of the climate chaos that we're already starting to see, they're also making clear that they are the leaders and they're at the forefront of these solutions.
You know, I just did a show on the Indonesian peat fires, and it struck me doing that, talking with the scientists, that it almost doesn't matter if we get rid of our SUV and get a fuel-efficient car, or even if we close a couple of coal plants, if we let this tropical biomass burn up into the atmosphere. I know Rainforest Action Network has been at the center of that for years. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we are echoing the call that has come from a number of civil society organizations within Indonesia demanding that the president of Indonesia enforce existing laws, that Indonesia take seriously this kind of pledge and commitment to really reduce its emissions. You know, it's important to point out that while the fires were burning for, you know, weeks, just this, they're still burning now, but when they were really intensely raging a few weeks ago in the lead up to Paris, it's important to know that those emissions exceeded the emissions of the U.S. economy. And there was a time where Indonesia, because of the burning of these rainforests and peat swamps, became the world's largest emitter. And that is not something that's really being focused on enough at these talks. And if we're serious about a climate solution, we need to be thinking about how to reduce those emissions. And we also know that the Indonesian government cannot do it alone. So they are asking for aid. The countries who have done the least to create the problem that we're in now, the least developed countries, should be supported in working to reduce their emissions. And we also know that as North Americans, which I'm based in the U.S., we are consuming products that are coming from these raging fires. The fires are being intentionally set by palm oil and pulp and paper companies in order to clear land, to plant these monocrops, to create cheap paper or pulp that goes into your fashion, or the cheapest vegetable oil in the world, which is palm oil. And so if you go to RAND.org, you can see how we can all take action to shift the market dynamics so that the Indonesian government can do more to stop these fires.
And I know that Rainforest Action Network has also been very active in tracking down who finances coal plants. It's kind of gratifying to see that the coal industry is collapsing, really. Their stock values are collapsing, and people who didn't heed the advice of environmentalists to get out of those investments have lost a lot of money. What's happening on the coal front?
Yes. So there was actually an article today, Friday, that Bloomberg Business put out, and it talked about how this ragtag band of activists is taking on the financing sector to come out of coal. And whatever they decide to call, you know, Rainforest Action Network and our allies, the fact is that banks know, and they're increasingly demonstrating with their policies and commitments that coal is unbankable. And so in the last year, we've had Bank of America, Citibank, Morgan Stanley, and Wells Fargo all make commitments to phase out their support for the coal mining sector. And at the same time, we know that our current economic scenarios and financial institutions are not going to provide the solution for stabilizing our climate. So while we're demanding they do more, we're also challenging the fact that our economic system is continuing to support coal in all the methods that it is.
What is your organization hoping to do at this COP21 meeting?
Well, we have a couple of goals. So we are watching to make sure that the voices of those who are often excluded from the talks are incorporated into some of the conversations happening within, you know, what's called the blue zone, which is the area that's kind of sealed off to diplomats and observers. And we're doing that through watchdogging what commitments are made, sharing information, working to lobby and to disrupt conversations. At the same time, we're also, you know, we know that the outcome of Paris will not be based on what diplomats agreed to. We need to stabilize the climate. We need to limit our emissions at a 1.5-degree temperature shift. And at best, we're going to get close to 3 coming out of these talks. Now, the momentum that we're seeing, we know, is coming from the fact that people-powered solutions and pressure that we are leveraging within each of our countries is starting to force our elected leaders to take things more seriously. And so part of what we're doing here is we're networking with all of our like-minded counterparts from across the globe who are demanding climate justice and equity and a reduction of emissions in order to build a much stronger movement so that while the floor might be set in Paris for the minimum amount that everyone will leave committing to reduce emissions, we will all go home and continue to push to stop dirty extractive projects, to stop financing of those projects, and to push for local solutions that are real solutions that will create climate equity.
We're starting to run out of time. Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know as your report from Paris?
I mean, the one thing that I would recommend is, you know, there's this sense, I think, it's that's being reported from outside of Paris that there's almost a clampdown on dissent and on protest. And I would say that there is like a vital heartbeat that we can feel. And although it is not as obvious as it might have been due to the crackdown on dissent, we should all know that it's surging, and we can all be a part of that when we go back to our respective countries or when we are at home. And the opportunity that we all have is to take hold of this moment and to decide what we are going to do to help stabilize the climate for ourselves and with others in our communities.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alex.
Radio EcoShock.
That was Lindsay Allen, Executive Director of the Rainforest Action Network. Tune in to their important work at ran.org. That's ran.org. From Paris, we welcome back University of Ottawa climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Alex. How are you this evening? It's this evening for me, anyway.
In Paris. Well, we should tell listeners this is being recorded on Friday, December 4th, as the talks are ongoing. Can you give us a kind of midterm report as we chat today, Paul?
Yeah, sure. These COPs are always a little bit hectic because, like, there's about 40,000 people at this one. I think the numbers would have been even 60,000, but the French government put a cap on the number of people, which I guess is why. I mean, it's a bit ridiculous to have this many people here. I think probably the more people you have, the less chance you have of getting agreements and so on. But no, it's been good. I mean, it's my second COP, as you know. I was in Lima, Peru last year, and there wasn't too much expectation that things would happen in Lima. It was just more of a preparatory thing for Paris. So this is the year. This is a very important year. So I've been going to a mixture of negotiations, side events by scientists. Today it was mostly investment community and climate change, what they're doing.
Wow. So did you get a sense of what they are doing?
Well, it was interesting because early in the afternoon, there was a talk by Mark Carney, who is head of the central bank in the UK now, right? He's Canadian. He went over there for that role. And he was talking with Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York City, and also, head of large financial investments and so on. So they were talking about the necessity of the investment community really getting to grips with the fact that we will be reducing CO2 emissions. Like, it's going to have to happen. I mean, already we're transitioning to renewables at a very slow pace, and it can be done way, way faster. And they were both of the view that most people in the investment community are becoming more aware of climate change, but they're still not there. They're going to be completely surprised by things like demand destruction. You know, as the world shifts away, there'll be less and less demand, and the prices won't go up anywhere. And this, of course, will be very bad for Canada. I mean, we've already seen our dollar, drop significantly in Canada, right? We were hovering about 90, 95 cents, and now we're 75 cents. And, if there's if out of Paris and subsequent meetings, we do get a global price on carbon, which I think is inevitable, it's just a matter of when, then our economy is going to take a big hit in Canada because of the Harper government putting all the eggs in the fossil fuel basket.
Well, the same thing has happened to Brazil, who were really counting on their offshore oil and gas, and they've just gone into a depression, according to Goldman Sachs. Russia is struggling with their budget. I mean, this is going to be a worldwide change, but a change for the better, we hope. Look, Paul, according to The Guardian, the Pacific Island nations, who will be swallowed up by rising seas, are pushing to lower the supposed safe limit from 2 degrees C of warming to 1.5 degrees. I'll bet you no one else wants to talk about that. Am I right?
Well, actually, that's not quite true. You know, the 2 degrees is not a scientific number, as we know. It's a number that came out of Copenhagen, I believe, and most scientists think that it's too high. I mean, it's, we're just over 1 degree, and we're getting all of these extreme weather events, and, these extreme weather events, if they happen simultaneously in food-producing areas, and we would go into a global food crisis. So the islands have all been saying 1.5. But I think there's actually about 100 countries or something altogether that sort of agree with the 1.5 number versus the 2-degree number. But those countries are not the dominant, any of the dominant countries on the planet. They do have Taboola does have a lot of company, a lot of other countries, you know, on board with their 1.5 degree number. But getting back to the investment side of it, this afternoon there was a whole series of events with the members of the investment community, sort of heads of mutual funds, heads of different, investment insurance companies and things like that in all different countries. And Tom Steyer introduced it, and he's a U.S., venture capitalist. He's right on board with, what's happening right up to speed with what's happening with climate change. In fact, he's countering, he's sort of the progressive version of the Koch brothers, right? I mean, completely against the Koch brothers, and he saw lots of money to throw behind his thing, his views and things. So it was interesting because he spoke first, and I managed to, drop him a business card, drop him my card, and talk to him briefly about startups in the climate solution space, that sort of thing. Because I am going to Norway, and I'm going to Norway after to talk to some people about climate change solutions. And we're starting a company called Gaia Engineering to look at some different carbon dioxide removal methods and things like that.
So what is the situation for would-be climate activists in Paris during the emergency lockdown for terrorism?
Basically, I mean, there's lots and lots of events going on. But the government, the Paris government, the French government, they've been limiting, like, large gatherings of people. So they don't want, like, a massive parade through Paris to the conference, for example, there'd be 20, 30, 50,000 people, right, in one space. So they're not allowing that sort of thing. But there's a lot, those people that were going to go on these marches and rallies and protests and things are still here. They're still in town. So they're kind of trying to figure out, things to do where they don't all get arrested en masse, although a lot of them don't mind that from what I've heard. But, it's kind of ironic that, the reason that they're not allowed to do their marches and things is for safety, and yet they tried to do one, and then the police, fired tear gas to disperse them. So it's kind of like, yeah, we're going to fire tear gas at you. It's for your safety, right? It's like Orwellian a bit.
It's definitely strange.
Yeah, but I'm staying in an interesting place. It's sort of like a backpacker's inn, and there's, many beds in a room. And it's interesting, some of the people I've been meeting, because there's one guy that actually cycled from Antarctica to Paris. So there's an event that he's holding next week. And it's two guys, they just got their PhDs, one in particular in Antarctica sea ice, and the Antarctic continental ice, and they're just frustrated because they don't see any, action being done. And then there's another guy I've met, he's worked in the solar industry for about 7 years, saved up a bit of money, and he wants to, do some climate activism stuff. So he's here, and because he's told me, apparently on Monday, at a hotel in Paris called Hotel California, there's going to be a day-long conference by all the climate deniers. So actually, Morana has done a movie, apparently, that's going to show, and, all of the names in, the big names in climate denial from the heartland and so on are going to be there, apparently. So I may have to go to that event and, do some, strong arguments, bring down some deniers or something. I'm thinking of seriously of going. It's in a very apt place, Hotel California, because you've probably heard of the song, Hotel California. And, there's a line in there that you can check in, but you can never check out. And most people don't know the story, but Hotel California was based off a hospital. So Hotel California was really a mental institution. So the name is very apt for climate deniers holding their conference there. I think it's great.
Yeah, it's the usual tired scientists, some of whom sowed doubt for money for the tobacco lobby in the 1990s. I don't think they're going to get a lot of traction in Paris. I really hope they don't.
Yeah, I don't think they are either. And this is why, a bunch of people that are thinking of going there and protesting against them are thinking, we shouldn't do anything. We should just ignore them. And like, if they go and protest and there's stuff going on, that will only help them get publicity, right?
So that's what I'm thinking. So, the media loves conflict, and you provide it. If they hold a party and nobody goes, it's probably the best.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Paul, I know you're studying about abrupt climate change. Are you picking up any tips or talk about that in Paris?
No, I mean, you don't hear about methane mentioned very often. You don't hear about the Arctic temperature amplification. I mean, you don't hear of the key things that are underway in the climate system. I mean, basically, Arctic start getting darker, warming like crazy, jet stream, the temperature difference to the equator dropping, jet stream slowing, becoming wavy, causing extreme weather, methane coming up, and then the sea ice could be gone by 2020, and we're under abrupt climate change. And no, I mean, you just don't hear any of this stuff. I mean, I gave press conferences, quite a few in Lima, and it's harder to book them this year, but I'm probably going to be involved in a couple at least. Radio interviews like with yourself and some other things, but I don't know if I'll be able to get, a venue like I had last year. But I am working with Stuart Scott, who's working on a movie, and he's got his Climate Matters website, and we had press coverage for the movie in the New York Times just last night. And also there's been articles. There was an article in Bloomberg Business on the methane and on AMEG, actually. It mentioned that a group called AMEG is actually proposing that we cool the Arctic to keep the methane in place. And this was the NGOs and groups like Arctic Methane Emergency Group.
Right. Okay. So these are the things they're not even talking about. What are the big problems that this Paris meeting is supposed to be trying to confront? What are they trying to come up with?
I mean, we've had 20 COPs and squats, so is this lucky 21? I mean, there's excitement here. There's sort of expectation that something will be that will happen. Of course, nobody will know until, it'll go to the last day, and then they'll negotiate all through the night, and they'll negotiate all through the next night, and then they'll come to some agreement. All the world leaders will come back in. The world leaders were all here on the first day, on the Monday, Sunday and Monday, and then they all left, and they'll all come back on the last day just because it looks like, group talks are breaking down or something, and then they'll all sign something and say, this was a success, right? So now, whether it is or not, I mean, because each country has these INDCs, intended as nationally determined contributions, but if you add up all those INDCs, we're still talking about, a 2.7 degree rise or something way outside the band of the so-called safe 2 degree, which we've just talked about being too high anyway. So, I mean, I've been talking about the three legs of a bar stool, and each leg is necessary for the bar stool to stand up. If you pull one away, then it topples over, it's unstable. And one of those legs of the bar stool is zeroing emissions. And that's what this whole conference is about, zeroing emissions. But I don't think that's sufficient. I think we also need carbon dioxide removal to get back down to about 350 parts per million. This is what James Hansen has been saying for a long time, although he doesn't like using the term carbon dioxide removal. And we also need to cool the Arctic with solar radiation management. I think that will buy us time to do these other things. So I think we have to do all of those three things. Otherwise, the bar stool will fall over, carrying my metaphor through.
Yeah, these COP meetings end up as a kind of theater. I'm often thinking I don't want to go into a hospital with a serious illness when I find that intern who's been working for 36 straight hours. That can cloud the judgment. And yet this is always how we end these things. The future of mankind should be decided by a bunch of overworked, very tired diplomats with no sleep.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the experience that a person has at the COP, I think everybody has a totally different experience, like, because there's so many people and there's so many events going on in parallel that everybody will have a different kind of experience. And there certainly is a disconnection between the policy wonks and the scientists and, the politicians. There's a complete disconnect. I mean, I know people that are the policy wonks now.
We got to start to wrap up here, Paul. What else should we know about this Paris meeting as we talk halfway along?
I try to put updates on sort of my experiences here onto my new website, paulbeckwith.net, every couple of days. And I managed to meet James Hansen, who I'd talked to, via emails and followed his work very closely. And he gave an excellent 45-minute talk, which I filmed in three different YouTube videos because I'm limited to 15 minutes, and I posted those. And I think that's the only copy that's out there on that particular talk. And then I did the same thing with Al Gore's speech the next day, and then today it was Carney and Bloomberg and Steyer on the investment side. So that's one thing with the cops. You know, you can run into all of the people. And unlike in Lima, when I had to leave early, I'm here for the duration this year. So I'm still working on getting a badge to get in next week, but there's lots of things I can do if I don't. And, you know, maybe I'll bump into some of the world leaders and things like that. So, you know, stay tuned with my website. And if you want another, you know, update towards the end of next week, I'm very happy to do that. And, you know, I have to be optimistic. I think that things are serious enough that this year, I think they will make progress. I mean, I wouldn't say it's enough to say this is the last COP. You know, we're making great gains, you know, because the thing is they, you know, I think the policymakers, they don't want all these things to be finalized because they get to keep coming to this conference. I think next year COP22 is in Morocco or something. So it's a bit ridiculous, actually, you know, that there's so many people involved and you know, it's crazy. It's like it's a self-propagating machine or something, you know. Everybody can go off for a couple of weeks on, you know, to some place in the world and the world thinks they're, you know, all negotiating carefully about climate change. I mean, like, what have they done in the last 20 years, right? I mean, we've known that, you know, so I'm a bit, you know, like, we don't need a COP anymore. Like, let's just put a global carbon, you know, fee and dividend. Global carbon fee and dividend. If country doesn't use it, then any fossil fuels that they get are higher priced. And then, you know, we can ramp up that price. I mean, this is what Canada should do, at least, you know, what Trudeau should be doing. And he's getting lots of people telling him this. So anyway, we'll see. We'll see. You know, we can remain hopeful. I mean, it's going to happen very, very soon. If it doesn't happen this conference, it'll maybe be, you know, half a year next year. I mean, you know, a couple more cities get flooded out. You know, the El Nino doesn't go away and the oceans stay super warm and we lose half of the marine life on the surface of the Pacific. And, you know, then there's huge food problems and so on. I mean, people are, you know, what's happening to our home, the Earth, is, you know, really starting to wake people up, I think. Just, you know, is there a critical mass yet? I mean, listening to the financial community, I mean, we've got Carney, we got Bloomberg, we've got Steyer, we've got, you know, these guys are really, you know, they're really powerful people in the financial world, you know, billions of dollars. There was like a fund manager from Sweden talking and there's like 30 billion euros or something. I don't know, some like huge numbers of money are under these people. And there's a huge risk. A lot of people are going to, you know, lose tremendous amounts of money when the demand destruction occurs and with fossil fuels. It's just a matter of time. It's happened already with coal. Right. And they're also realizing that the natural gas is not going to be a big help. You know, they were still trying to push that, right, make the U.S. energy independent. But it's just a matter of time.
I'm a little disturbed to hear the next meeting will be in Morocco, because from my point of view, I would love to see one of these COPs held in a city where millions of people can gather around the headquarters and say, you're not coming out until you do something that will really save the climate for our children and grandchildren. And I don't think Morocco is going to be the place to do that. So as you say, this will probably run on for a few years, even though we do know what to do. We've been getting a report direct from Paris from our regular correspondent, I think, climate scientist Paul Beckwith. Follow Paul on Facebook and definitely on YouTube. You can learn a lot from Paul's YouTubes. And I'll put links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much, Paul, and good luck at the Climate Circus.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Now it's time to talk about real solutions in the real world. This is part of my continuing coverage of ways to stuff carbon back into the soil with nature-based agriculture and biochar. When world politicians and their experts meet in Paris for the COP21 Climate Summit, most will seek industrial answers for what they see as an industrial problem. Perhaps they'll hear about machines to capture carbon and feed it back through a maze of new pipelines to old wells. Maybe dangerous geoengineering will be on the menu. But they almost didn't hear about the least known source of greenhouse gases and the single best solution to reducing carbon in the atmosphere. I'm talking about clearing land for food, industrial agriculture, and ways to put carbon back in the soil. And that wasn't even on the menu until a recent move by France to put it there. Our guest, Dr. Benoît Lambert, has been tracking this key issue. Benoît is from Quebec in Canada, and he works with a company called Biochar Génération. Benoît, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thank you for having me.
We have had experts in so-called carbon farming on Radio EcoShock. Thomas Garneau, Albert Bates, Courtney White, and Alan Savory come to mind as my guests. How is it possible using the soil to capture carbon was not even on the agenda for Paris until recently?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the main reason for that is because it was pretty easy until now to reach targets that were in the Kyoto Protocol. As you know, there were a slowdown of the economy in 2008. Eastern blocs fell apart. The target was 5%, which was really easy to reach. There's only Canada that withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol. But besides that, all the countries reached their target really easily. There were some talks about land use and land use change in forestry called LULUCF and the jargon of the carbon credits and the UN meetings, especially in Durban in 2011. You know, so there were talks about sinks and there were talks about sequestration. But it is the responsibility of the governments, the countries, to reduce their emission. And they are the ones presenting methodologies. They are the ones proposing methodologies, companies in particular, you know, private companies present project with methodologies in the UN frame. So it was not that it was not possible to do it. It's just that the science was not really there yet in some cases. And there were just no need to, you know, the price of carbon is just way too low for that at this moment. But I think, you know, there's been a shift in the EU. They've been researching the possibility to use soils and lands to sequester carbon for quite some time, 5 or 6 years. And one man was involved in that. His name is Stéphane Le Foll. And Stéphane Le Foll is now the Minister of the Agriculture and Forestry in France. And he's the one that has been really promoting this idea for the Paris meeting.
And who is Laurence Tubiana, and what role does she play?
Okay, so Laurence Tubiana has been the director of IDRI, Institut pour le Développement Durable and International Relations for Sustainable Development and International Relations in Paris. She's been a high rank civil servant for many years. She's been a friend of the former Prime Minister of France, Socialist Prime Minister. So she's been around the governments and especially the Socialist Party in France for some time, and now she's the ambassador in charge of the conference in Paris, special ambassador. And Laurence Tubiana, I think I've known about the possibility to sequester greenhouse gases, carbon, with using soils for a little while. But it's really Stéphane Le Foll, I believe, that was really the one understanding the science and promoting the idea.
All right. Now, I think we have to be clear with our listeners that our current industrial farming uses loads of fossil fuel products, including fertilizers, pesticides, and herbicides. It is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions, not a help at this time. So how big a factor is food production to the overall burden of greenhouse gases that we're emitting? Do you know?
It's about 30-40%. Something in that range, I would believe, I would say. Some might even go further. What we have to understand is that emissions have started basically when we started agriculture 10,000 years ago. As soon as humanity started plowing, we started emit greenhouse gases. And actually, we can see on the curve of CO2, on the killing curve, that, you know, there were emissions before industrialization. And quite a, you know, about 30 ppm or something like that. It was not like threatening humanity on this planet, but it was already there. And basically with industrialization, the use of fertilizers, the use of tractors, the use of fossil fuel, and the compacting of soils and all of these bad things that we're doing to the soils, we've accelerated greatly, of course, the population that is growing. We're just accelerating the destruction of the soils. Basically, soils are a big part of the problem, but the good news is that it's also a huge part of the future solution, I believe.
So we need a huge turnaround in our food system. I mean, first of all, Benoit, we need to get to zero emissions farming. Can we do that?
Oh, we can be carbon negative.
Uh-huh.
We can sequester huge amounts. And there are people that are, you know, well-known scientists, as Thomas Goro that you interviewed previously, that say that you know, we can actually put back 400 gigaton of carbon in the soils, and actually the soil is the only way we can do that. We have to be carbon negative. This idea that we will limit it to 2 degrees Celsius is, of course, a nonsense. We know that, you know, eventually the oceans will expand and we'll get a 5, 6, 7 meters rise of the oceans. So a small island would disappear, coral reefs would disappear, you know, eventually if we get to 2 degrees Celsius, which is not that much of an impossibility, as you know, we're already at 0.85. We don't want to get to 2 degrees Celsius. And the only way we won't get to 2 degrees Celsius is by using lands. I'm talking about grasslands that cover 2/3 of lands, emerged lands in the world, and I'm talking about agricultural lands, and put back carbon into those soils.
So if billions of people insist on eating meat, do you think Alan Savory's methods of herd management could turn that industry from a greenhouse gas maker to carbon capture on a scale that matters?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think I have to say, at first when I heard about Alan Savory's theory, I was very surprised and I was kind of very skeptic. But yes, I think it's proving to work. And one of the examples recently at the meeting of Artisans of the Grasslands with the Savory Institute was in Argentina. You know, that they're using sheep to restore soils. Of course, you gotta move them around the proper way. We have to mimic nature. We have to learn mimic nature. They call it holistic grazing management. And basically, what they're doing is that they're mimicking nature. So in previous times, there were predators that were moving the herds around, and the herds were moving fast, and they weren't grazing too much, too long. So they weren't killing the plants, and so they weren't creating this desertification that we see when there's no predators. So basically, if we move the herds around fast enough, they will leave manure around and they will leave urine around that will actually enrich the soils. And using that technique of fast-moving herds, you can actually have a lot more animals, 2 or 3 times more animals than we have today. And they've shown that in Argentina. It works with sheep. Of course, it works with cattle, too. And as we know now, if you actually take all the animals out, as they did in the Midwest, in the States, or they did in Africa, in some part of Africa, you actually accelerate desertification. You don't slow it down. Animals are not the reason for desertification. It's the bad management of herds, of animals, a misunderstanding of how nature works, a misunderstanding of how soils have been created through the thousands of years. That is at the root of the problem of desertification that we see all around the world.
We've just heard about biochar from our Radio EcoShock guest, Albert Bates. Benoit Lambert, how are you involved in that?
I actually believe that Canada would be the best place to create a big-scale industry with biochar, because I worked in the forestry sector for some time, and there's so much residues, waste from forestry. Not only from forestry, just from branches that are broken, you know, when there are storms around Canada. We could actually pyrolyze this biomass, this very good quality biomass. Most of the time it's very dry already, and produce it's a charcoal-like product that can be used in agriculture. And actually, it would actually be a primer to jumpstart soils that have been really badly affected by plowing and badly affected by using too much fertilizers and letting the soils bare for as we're doing in conventional agriculture. So we could use biochar as a primer to jumpstart rapidly a new agriculture towards healthy soils.
Now, getting back to Paris, what have you heard about the planned discussions about soil capture of carbon there?
There's a project, a declaration that will be made on December 1st. Declaration of intention. It's called the 4 per 1,000 project, a research project that is being proposed by France. Yeah, it's a first time that within an official meeting that they're insisting to use soils to put carbon back in the soils. It's a great initiative. I mean, it's a huge change in the way land is being seen into the negotiations.
What do the numbers 4 out of 1,000 mean?
It basically means that, you know, this is enough carbon being put back in the soils to stop global warming fairly rapidly within 10 to 20 years. That's what he's saying. I don't know the details, you know, how many tons it means per hectare. And so I think it's about a ton per hectare per year or something like that. But those numbers, surprisingly, are fairly easy to reach. I mean, we have proof of that with Gabe Brown. We have proof of that with David Brandt, for example, that has been doing the no-tillage and cover crops, holistic grazing management for the last 30, 40 years in the case of David Brandt. There are many examples around the world of people that have been practicing this. This is like organic farming multiplied by 3 or 4, because they're not just not using chemicals. They're actually feeding their soil, you know, with having their soil covered all the time, barren soil, and using the roots to put carbon in the soil. The roots of plants, cover crops, can actually bring carbon in the soil. And we all know that globulin, which is the product that sticks everything of the carbon together, called globulin, has been discovered in 1997, plays a big role in the dynamic of life in the soils. So all of this has been shown, but funny enough, it's been shown by people that are not necessarily academic, but people that are practicing agriculture. Not necessarily people that are involved with big research center, but that have been understanding how soils work. And I've been trying making error, but with all the knowledge that they've gathered for the last 30, 40 years, like the case of Gabe Brown is quite impressive. I mean, we can put together a package of measures that will bring back the carbon in soils from 1% below 1% in some cases to 7-8% within 10, 15 years maybe, which is, you know, it's amazing. It's really surprising that this idea is just emerging now, but it's the way it is. So it's good news.
So one concern that some people have is whether the carbon captured by different farming methods will really stay in the soil for very long. Will it?
Yes, it will. It will. Well, biochar, as you know, is recalcitrant to decomposition. We know that because of the terra preta in the Amazon, the black dirt of the Amazon that has been there for thousands of years in some cases and is just not moving. So recalcitrant decomposition means it's not like compost. Compost will get back into the air very rapidly, same with manure, but charcoal doesn't. It's just there for thousands of years. And it's the same with the carbon that is being brought in the soils by roots. It just doesn't go back to the atmosphere so rapidly unless it's being plowed deeply, like some farmers still do, unfortunately. Plowing is a very bad practice. I mean, we have to understand that plowing doesn't exist in nature. Barren soil doesn't exist in nature. And we have to mimic nature. We have to mimic nature. If we don't do that, we're doing mistakes after mistakes.
Well, this is something I've been concerned about. I mean, farming has been about passing down techniques through generations. It's still that way in many parts of the world. And when we add in lack of education, perhaps hundreds of languages and millions of people outside the internet, are we dreaming to think we could change world farming into a climate tool in time to really work?
Well, this is what I'm saying. This has to be a pharaonic dimension if we're serious about solving the climate crisis. this cannot be of small scale. You know, I mean, yes, it will be small scale for small farmers, but, you know, governments have to get ambitious about this. And you know, the World Bank has to put billions maybe in it. And, well, you know, I say the World Bank, I'm talking about governments in general, if we really take the problem of climate crisis seriously. But we have no other tool. Of course, we have to reduce emissions. We know that by now. I mean, we have to go towards renewable energies, electric car, whatever, you know, bicycles. But we have to take the steering wheel of the climate. And the only steering wheel we have is to use the soil. You know, if we really want to start seriously manage the carbon cycle, the only solution is to use the soils.
So, Benoit Lambert, if I go down the street asking people about solutions for climate change, I'll bet few will name agriculture as a way out, and even fewer will know what biochar is. Why do you think this important subject has so little media attention, and what can we do to get this movement really rolling?
Yeah, good question. I did a conference in February in Geneva. Many of the people in the audience have been activists for 10, 20 years, some even more than that, and they had never heard of what I was talking about. You know, I'm talking about people that are very, very educated about environmental issues. So, you know, they were like, they're mind blown. You know, it's just like, wow, what are you talking about here? Using animals to, they always thought that animals were the problem, you know, that grazing was the problem. So did I. So this is a shift of paradigm, you know, a paradigm shift that we're facing. And I was as surprised as they were when I first heard about biochar. Then from biochar, I moved into carbon farming 2 years ago, discovered all of these great sites like Soil for Climate. And I was really so surprised. I realized that biochar was only one of the many solutions that we have. And the reason for this is that people don't know about it. I think it's because the science is not really driving this movement. It's farmers isolated on their farm that have decided to do things differently and have seen that it's working and have been very successful doing it. And now they're starting to talk about it. Now they're coming out and saying, wait a second, this all industrial agriculture is not working. It's destroying the soils. It's killing the life in soils. And we need that life in soil to have healthy soil and have productive lands. And yes, we can actually be more productive than conventional agriculture if we make our soils healthy. Yeah, so the science is lagging behind farmers, basically. So this is why the media don't talk about it very much, because the media think, you know, if it doesn't come from a university or a research center, it must be shaky. Well, in fact, it's the conventional agriculture that is very shaky. But they're running, you know, finance, and they're running, as we know, the corporate media.
So as we wrap up, I'm curious about your work in Quebec. What are you up to?
Well, I've been trying to develop biochar as an industry for 5-6 years since I came back from Europe. I lived in Europe for 20 years. Yeah, possibilities, I believe, are there. There are huge mountains of wood residues in northern Canada, generally speaking. And Canada has 300 tons of carbon per hectare, something like that. This is like 6-7 times more than what you find in the southern United States and in most of the United States, in fact. So the level of carbon is high enough in Canada that we could produce biochar on a big scale sustainably. So, yeah, there are possibilities to use biochar, as I said, as a primer to jumpstart healthy soils and healthy agriculture.
So are there web resources or social media sites on this topic?
In English, we have Soils for Climate. That is really a place where all the information transit. And we also have Soil Age on Google.
Thank you so much. We've been talking about the number one world-scale way to harmlessly remove, beneficially remove, greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. We can end fossil fuel farming and put carbon back in the soil. Our guest is Dr. Benoit Lambert from Biochar Génération in Quebec, Canada. Merci, Benoit.
Merci, Alex. À bientôt.
We are totally out of time.
My thanks to everyone who tweeted about last week's show with Dr. Kevin Anderson. It literally went around the world. Get links for this program in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and let's get together again next week.
Joined by an enlightened gentleman, Robin Philpott. Are you there, sir?
Yes. Hi, Phil.
Thank you for joining us. I told our listeners that you had been awarded another prize for some for your good work. So this has to do with history. Is that accurate? What is this award you recently won?
Well, it's an award given out since the early 70s, and it's called in French is Patriote de l'année, in other words, Patriot of the Year, and it's given, awarded in the month of November to people involved in the general political struggle, in cultural figures, and very, very impressive list of people to join. And so they awarded it to me. It's given by the Société Saint-Jean-Baptiste, which was founded in the 1830s, when this period of, when there was the Mackenzie and the Papineau rebellions, or yes, you could almost call them revolutions, that were...
By the way, you know about that in Quebec, Lower Canada, but here it is less noted.
Yeah, which is quite striking. And so they awarded this, and then part of my job as being Patriot of the Year, which is a very pleasant job, is to they have every year commemorations of the rebellions, of the victory over the British troops. One is the 23rd of December of November, in a place called Saint Denis sur Richelieu, which is just southeast of Montreal, on the Richelieu River. And then they have commemorations up in the northeast of Montreal, which is Saint-Eustache, where Colborne attacked a church where the Patriots had taken refuge, and he.
I gather it wasn't a Protestant church.
It wasn't a Protestant church.
Oh, that makes it legal. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Exactly. But they did, they actually, they really were brutalized. Villages, burnt down villages, burnt down farms, and a lot of people were killed. And at the same time, there was the rebellion in Upper Canada, which is now Ontario. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that at this celebration just a few weeks ago, and this is at the in Saint-Denis, and there they have it's a procession, it's a commemoration. It's been going on it started up again in the 1960s. It has been marked previously, but then since the 60s, it's been every year. Mm-hmm. And the people who organize it also show pictures on the wall. And this is in a very, very old church, which is, but it's a Republican type of celebration in this church. And they showed pictures of monuments in Quebec and elsewhere to the memory of the Patriots and the reformers in Upper Canada, Mackenzie and so on. And they show this arch, which was the memorial arch, which used to be overlooking the Horseshoe Falls at Niagara. And it was a big arch. It was built after in the style of the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Mm-hmm. And it was inaugurated in 100 years after this rebellion in Ontario and in Quebec, led by Mackenzie and Papineau. And it had their names of all the people who were hanged. In Ontario, there were 20 people hanged, including Samuel Lount, and all these names. And then in Quebec, there were 12 people hanged, but there were a lot of other people killed. And their names were on this arch. Uh-huh. They were called Mackenzie panels, and the arch was, I can remember it vaguely when I was there very young, but the arch was inaugurated by the Prime Minister of Canada, William Lyon Mackenzie, and it was an example of people fighting for principles of responsible government, and Quebec was independence, but they were in alliance with the people, the reformers in Ontario. Now, the big story, which I think is the big story, and it's absolutely, in a sense, it's a sin, is that that arch was dismantled in 1967 on the 100th anniversary of Canada, and it was disappeared. and nobody, people don't know it, and any efforts to try and bring back the panels, because these panels are wonderful monuments to our common history. And the history of ideals and fighting for Republican principles have just been disappeared. And I think it's quite significant that was you can find out. And when I was speaking, I said
it's kind of a mystery, right? They didn't. Even now, we're not quite clear how they rationalized that and other such things.
Well, at the time, they said it was for a centennial project. They took it down. but they made them so they were no longer there. And my suspicion, and the suspicion that people have, is that there were such very powerful ideas, you know. It was a break with the monarchy. It was standing up for the principles of the French Revolution, basically. Mm-hmm.
That goes over very big in Upper Canada.
Sorry?
I said, references to the French Revolution is not allowed here. They actually take those papers away from you if you try to come in. Yes.
And the American Revolution as well. I mean, the idea of principles of responsible government for the people, by the people, that's just something which is rejected.
Well, MacDonald said it won't work.
Exactly. Those ideas, and it also showed an alliance, which could have been an alliance, which we should still think about, you know, an alliance and progressive ideas between Quebec, which works as an autonomous place, and Canada, which is what they were doing, Mackenzie and Papineau. And at this celebration, there's former premiers of Quebec go to us, and I remember, when I spoke there, I said, you know, if people from Ontario know their history, they have to come to Saint-Denis-sur-Richelieu, and see these.
Well,
these
by the
things.
Way, there's a famous name that they don't know who was one of the leaders of that battle in the Richelieu Valley. Tell us, who was he? Because people
Wilfred Nelson, and this is the monument where.
And what was his ethnicity or his background?
He was a Protestant. He was an English Protestant.
English
but
Protestant.
Secondary.
Okay. That's
he was a Republican. He and his brother Robert Nelson, they were allies with the. They were in the Patriot Party with Papineau. Papineau was the leader.
And
they also had Irish.
He was a doctor, wasn't he? Wasn't he a medical doctor?
Yeah. And then there were Irish people, because there were a lot of Irish immigrants. And, of course, Irish and English were not the same people, as we know, you know.
Yes,
and
that's
but they had this. They managed to rally people to ideas that were powerful ideas, and which makes you think the reason they disappeared that arch was because
arch.
It did represent interesting ideas.
Well, we really ought to, as a duty as patriots in Canada, to ask the government to put it back, shouldn't we?
Yeah, and to find, I mean, apparently that.
Did you find my monument? There's a monument here.
Yeah.
By the way, there's also, did you tell me there's a flag? Mackenzie had a flag,
yeah.
and you can see that flag in at the monument
at
in Richelieu Valley?
At this commemoration, they had a procession, and they had the Patriot flag, which is a tricolor. You know, it was inspired after the three colors, as the French Revolution and the Irish flag and the, you know, Republican flags were the freedom, liberty, equality, and fraternity. And that's the idea. Then there was the Mackenzie had a flag, which was with two stars. And in the procession here at Saint-Jean-sur-Richelieu, they had the Mackenzie flag as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's up permanently, but each year they bring it out. And these people, they remember which I think is quite striking, that is where you can find out about Upper Canada's history.
Yeah. Go to Quebec and learn about Upper Canada.
Yeah. Well,
we weren't looking for a monument as tall as Brock's. They can still have Brock looking down on us all, but at least give us that, monument they took down.
Yeah, and it was a big monument, and it was right in a very key place, you know, overlooking the Horseshoe Falls, which is where people go, and it had the names of Papineau, Mackenzie, all the people who had been hanged, and on the back it had Cavalier de La Salle and some explorers, it was a real it would help people to understand what Canadian history, unfortunately has been buried in many ways.
It here certainly has, and you've called attention to it. I would say thank you very much. By the way, this is Robin Philpott, who just won this award, the Patriot of the Year. I think it might be a good idea, based on what happened in Niagara Falls, if you would post a guard on your monument so that nobody carries it off in the middle of the night.
Yeah, for some centenary. Yes. I mean, you should check your monuments now, because they're going to be celebrating the 150th.
Yes.
Anniversary in 2 years, and you might see some other good monuments disappear and put up other ones to Brock.
It's the War of the Monuments. Robin, thank you very much. It's been very edifying. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
Yep.
Bye.
Robin Philpott, publisher of Baraka Books. This is CIUT Data Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Thank you, Phil Conlon. Thank you, Hanny. Thank you, Elena. We will see you next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about the renewed debate on America's epidemic of firearms violence and the failure of Congress to enact basic gun safety regulations. Climate activist Heather Doyle, who describes the mistreatment she suffered during a civil disobedience arrest at the construction site of Maryland's Cove Point Natural Gas Export Terminal. And Patty Lavera of Food and Water Watch, who explains why her group and others oppose the FDA's recent approval of genetically modified salmon to be sold in food stores across the U.S. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Despite uncertainty, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico made $354 million in debt payments on December 1st, but warned it may not be able to pay all of its debts in coming months. Puerto Rico's governor, Alejandro García Padilla, issued orders to claw back a portion of the revenue dedicated to paying some of its lower-ranked debts, a decision which is likely to set off lawsuits. Currently, Puerto Rico's public debt sells for 75 cents on the dollar. Governor Padilla told a U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee his island government was broke and faced an impending liquidity crisis, insisting, "This is a distress call from a ship of 3.5 million people that is adrift at sea." For a decade, Puerto Rico has been mired in recession and increasing poverty. The island's average income is now 30% below that of Mississippi, the poorest state in the U.S. Former New York State Lieutenant Governor Richard Ravitch, who ran the New York City's transit system in the 1980s, declared that without bankruptcy protection, Puerto Rico would face endless acrimonious litigation in both New York and Puerto Rican courts. Julio Lopez of the New York advocacy group Make the Road told the Guardian newspaper that the Federal Reserve may have the authority to intervene to push bondholders to renegotiate the Commonwealth's soaring debt, a move that would not require congressional approval. Raw sewage and other pollutants in the waters off Rio de Janeiro presented a serious health threat to German Olympic sailor Eric Heil, who was treated last August for MRSA, a flesh-eating bacteria, after he participated in a pre-Olympic sail in coastal Brazil. Water tests commissioned by the Associated Press last summer found that water pollution and pathogens off Rio's coast is more extensive than previously disclosed. Raw sewage from upstream communities and storm drains pour into the city's Guanabara Bay. Bacteria tests confirm that viruses directly linked to sewage were 1.7 million times higher than safe levels in the U.S. and Europe. Yet the World Health Organization has vacillated on whether or not to require Rio's Olympic Games officials to conduct tests for viral pathogens in the wake of the AP's July report. In winning its bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics, the government pledged to clean up the city's polluted waters, including upgrading their sewage treatment plants. Brazilian officials now acknowledge that won't be possible. During last summer's trial runs in Rio, the International Sailing Federation and the World Rowing Federation reported that 7% of its Olympic athletes became ill through exposure to Rio's polluted waters. With new large donors from Silicon Valley, the Democratic Party is suddenly having an identity crisis when it comes to defining workers' rights. The nation's tech Democrats, who made fortunes on the sharing economy, want the government to support expansive trade deals, performance-based funding that encourages charter schools to abandon teachers' unions, and authorize an unlimited number of visas to import high-skilled workers. New York Times political columnist Thomas Edsel recently opined, the replacement of working-class whites with upscale professionals has turned the Democratic coalition into an alliance built on class division. Edsel further stated, while constituting a minority, the relatively upscale wing clearly dominates the party and provides the majority of activists who run campaigns, serve as delegates to the convention, and have become the core of the party's donor base. The communications industry has now eclipsed labor unions as one of the larger donors to liberal candidates, and as a result, on nearly every major issue, the Democratic Party leadership sides with the tech industry whenever it conflicts with labor union priorities. According to the Guardian newspaper, tech donors are now a big factor in determining the Democratic 2016 presidential nominee, where Hillary Clinton has embraced tech industry views on education and immigration, while insurgent Bernie Sanders is appealing to blue-collar workers and promoting an FDR New Deal Democratic Socialist agenda. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Over the last 2 weeks, the nation has witnessed two high-profile mass shooting incidents. First in Colorado Springs on November 27th, where a lone gunman attacked a Planned Parenthood clinic that killed three and wounded nine. Then on December 2nd, when a couple attacked a holiday gathering at San Bernardino, California's Inland Regional Center, killing 14 and wounding 21 others. One of the shooters, Saeed Farouk, worked with and knew his victims in an attack that appears to be motivated by extremist Islamist ideology. There is now a mass shooting every day in the United States, with a mass shooting defined as incidents in which four or more people are reported to have either been killed or injured. But while mass murder incidents understandably capture headlines and dominate cable news programs, the deadly crisis in gun violence can be seen in the 30,000 murders and suicides that occur each year in the U.S. And while the public is angry about the epidemic of gun violence, the NRA and their well-compensated allies in the Republican Party have consistently blocked common-sense gun regulations that would make it more difficult for felons, individuals with a history of mental illness, and even those listed on the federal terrorist watch list to buy firearms. Your reporter spoke with Ladd Everett, director of communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about America's ongoing gun violence crisis and the continuing failure of Congress to enact basic gun safety regulations, such as universal background checks.
It almost appears to me at this point that the details of any given mass shooting tragedy don't matter so much. They're all similar stories. Even the San Bernardino story has many elements of previous mass shootings. I mean, there's an element of workplace violence there with this disagreement at the party that became violent. Certainly, it's a terrorism case, obviously, so it has ties to international terrorism and that element of violence. You know, the violence we're seeing in this country almost appears to me now like anarchy. It's just spontaneous. It's happening constantly. These are major incidents, not lesser incidents. You know, in many ways, it reminds me of what our founders wrote about the period during the Articles of Confederation, really the unrest in the country we saw at that point, all the violence, the rebellion. It feels to me like we're starting to get back to there, you know. That's of course why the founders wrote the Constitution in the first place, because the government could not tamp down on it. And I think that's exactly what we're seeing today. You know, the NRA has created a situation where they've made it impossible for our government to control the violence and reduce it. So, you know, it's got to start with regime change. It's like anything else. It's going to start with regime change. And you know, the November 2016 elections are going to be hugely important. There's just no doubt about it. And, you know, we're going to go full out, and we're going to be resourced. We'll have Mayor Bloomberg's pack and also Gabby Gifford's pack, and, you know, we're going to go fully at them. And I am optimistic moving forward. I think a lot of what we're seeing now is reactionary politics, you know, all the hate speech and all this craziness. But, you know, that doesn't have an indefinite lifespan.
Ladd, after these recent mass shooting incidents, there's been a predictable spike in sales of guns all across the country.
I was here in Connecticut at a sporting goods store, and I saw people lined up to get guns. It's quite a disturbing cycle of violence there in the public square, and then how that translates to people's fear and concern and rumors of gun confiscations and how that drives up sales of guns across the country.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's no shortage of fear-mongering in, you know, mainstream media, in mainstream politics today. It's gotten to extreme levels. And there's a lot of violence occurring, and there's a lot of hate speech, too. There's a tremendous amount right now in our politics and our media, on, you know, on Fox News. There's a tremendous amount of hate speech people are ingesting daily. And it's, you know, when you combine things like, for example, hate speech with, you know, insurrectionism, the belief that as an individual you have a right to use force of arms to engage in political violence if you feel oppressed, it's just it's a really lethal cocktail out there right now. And it's sad, you know, as someone who, you know, as folks who love their country, it's hard to look at this and to wonder why we have allowed this to continue so long. I mean, I'm very optimistic we're going to get it fixed, but, you know, one day we're going to have to answer for why we allowed it to go on so long, and I don't know if there is a good answer.
Ladd, assess for us the recent U.S. Senate vote where Republicans essentially blocked a series of proposed gun regulations, including an act to bar individuals on the federal terrorist watch list from purchasing guns, and a measure to close background check loopholes for felons and those with a history of mental illness seeking to buy guns.
Yeah, you know, that's an area for quite a bit of optimism. You're talking about this, they call it the terror gap, you know, allowing these folks on the watch list to legally buy guns. And Republicans have been running from the issue. They don't want to touch it. They don't want to vote on it. Like you alluded to, the Democrats did make them take a couple of test votes on it, a rules vote and then a non-binding vote. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting rhetoric coming out. Like Kelly Ayotte, for example, was tweeting the other day that she supports doing something about this, even though she voted the wrong way on the non-binding vote. So I think a lot of politicians are feeling a great deal of pressure on it, which is great. And, you know, now, you know, we have to see if how the Democrats will, you know, force a vote on this, if they can do that. But that's a great one for people to be calling their members of Congress on right now and just telling them, you know, there is no way in the world people on the terrorist watch list, if they can't fly on planes, they shouldn't be legally stockpiling all the guns they want. I mean, right now, literally, someone on the terrorist watch list could walk into Bob's Gun Shop and buy 1,000 AR-15, buy his entire inventory pretty much if Bob was down with it, and that's it, nothing. No attention from authorities, and that's crazy. So, that's one I think we can get some movement on. We'll see how that unfolds.
That was Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about the campaign to enact common sense gun regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last February, climate activists Carling Sutherland and Heather Doyle climbed atop a crane in order to interrupt construction of Dominion Energy's Cove Point Liquefied Natural Gas Export Terminal in Lusby, Maryland, a $3.8 billion project on the shores of Chesapeake Bay. Opponents say the terminal and related industrial infrastructure will bring noise, toxic air pollution, and the possibility of an explosion to residents living in the neighborhood located near the site. They also say the terminal will greatly increase fracking throughout the Marcellus Shale region, where natural gas is extracted, and blow a hole in any attempt to rein in carbon pollution, the major contributor to climate change. The women are members of a local direct action group called Stopping Extraction and Exports Destruction, or SEED. After the pair were arrested, Sutherland accepted a sentence of probation, while Doyle opted for a 40-day jail sentence so as not to limit her options for participating in direct action after she's released. Upon the completion of their trials, both activists filed formal complaints against the Calvert County Sheriff's Office for their treatment during their arrests, both the dangerous way in which they were removed from the crane and other abuses. Those complaints were later dismissed, and the women were then slapped with an additional charge, making a false statement to police. Heather Doyle is now pursuing the case in court. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who's been active in opposing the Cove Point LNG terminal, spoke with Doyle as she awaited trial on the new charge. Here she describes the mistreatment suffered, why she believes activists should challenge police charges in court, and what she hopes to accomplish in the case.
There was one sheriff who had been up there with me previously, and then there were two other officers who held both of my arms back, one each, and the other sheriff was standing over top of me, and he pressed his forearm into my throat, right into my larynx. And he did that for what felt like a really long time, and then he let off, and then he stared at me, and then he pushed his forearm back into my throat again for a shorter period of time. After he did all those things, and I wasn't resisting at all. I was being held down by, you know, two other very large men. I'm like a pretty small person, and I wasn't struggling at all. After the sheriff choked me, he lifted up his boot, and he placed the bottom of his boot into my chest, right into my rib cage, and started pressing down really hard right onto my sternum. And I felt like I was being crushed. And then he eventually let off, and he said, oh, you know, like I just tripped or I misplaced my foot when I was stepping over you. We filed formal complaints, both me and the other activists. We filed formal complaints about our mistreatment by the sheriff. So those formal complaints were lodged with the Calvert County Sheriff's Office. Because what happened to me included an assault by one of the sheriffs, my report was a brutality complaint. And then the other person's complaint was just more generally like how they risked her life, like up at the top of a crane.
So what happened after you filed your complaints?
They've charged us under, it's a misdemeanor statute that is just false statement to a police officer. Well, they investigated our complaints and concluded there was no merit for it, but then they turned around and also filed these new charges against us. They filed the charges in the beginning of July.
Heather Doyle, you're going back to court in January, and you're not sure when your trial will be. But why are you taking this case to trial when so many activists, when they're arrested, just pay a fine or plead to a lower charge and don't go through the court process, which is a real hassle, as, of course, you know, not to mention expensive?
Specifically with this charge, you know, we see this as an intimidation tactic designed to stop people who are opposing this, the Dominion Cove Point LNG export facility, which is still deeply in the process of being built and endangering 20,000 people living in Lesby. That feels extremely important to me, that this is a continuation of this fight. And that, you know, as folks who are, you know, active in resisting extraction industry and these big corporations who have bought their way into, like bought a lot of power and influence in Calvert County, we need to keep standing up to that because it's just about retaliation and trying to shut us down to keep us from continuing the fight. And then just specifically in terms of, you know, why I fight this charge, because I didn't lie about what happened to me. I was assaulted by the Calvert County Sheriff during this action.
A lot of activists trying to stop Dominion's construction at Cove Point note that some Calvert County sheriffs wear two hats. They work for the county, and they are also paid to do security for Dominion. And you and other activists say that's a conflict of interest. Are you going to use your trial to expose some of this conflict?
Absolutely. The sheriffs have an interest in trying to neutralize people who are trying to stop this Dominion export facility from being built because county has a security services agreement with Dominion, and Dominion is paying Calvert County $1.24 million a year to provide them with security. Additionally, a lot of the Calvert County sheriffs are working as contracted security for the project. So the lines are really blurred here. So we're hoping that in the course of this trial, it'll become apparent that the reason that I've been charged and I'm being put through this whole new process is because The Calvert County Sheriff's Office has decided to spend a whole lot of their time and effort building a case against me. And it's almost like there's a large corporation that's paying them a lot of money to try to get an activist however they can.
That was Heather Doyle, a climate activist with the group SEED. For more information on the group's mission and their legal defense fund, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration's recent approval of genetically modified salmon, created by the Aqua Bounty Company of Massachusetts to be sold to consumers across the country, is meeting with strong opposition from consumer, environmental groups, and the fishing industry. The genetically engineered fish, known as the Aqua Advantage salmon, has genes from three other species, including DNA from an Atlantic salmon, a growth gene from a Pacific Chinook salmon, and a growth on switch from an eel-like fish, the ocean pout. The sale of what some critics now call the frankenfish will mark the first time that a genetically engineered animal has been approved to enter America's food system. The Aqua Advantage salmon grow twice as fast as typical native salmon species and consume about 10% less food, great attributes to maximize corporate profits. In early 2012, consumer groups Food and Water Watch, Consumers Union, and the Center for Food Safety unsuccessfully filed a petition asking the FDA to test the genetically engineered salmon as a food additive, not as a new animal drug, which requires a less rigorous review. Environmental groups also urged the FDA to conduct an environmental study, citing concerns that GE salmon could escape and carry disease to and/or breed with native wild salmon species. But in the end, the FDA approved the sale of the Aqua Bounty salmon using less thorough testing, reviewing a company study that only examined six salmon. But what's more alarming to opponents of genetically engineered food products is that the government won't require the labeling of these fish. Your reporter spoke with Patty Lavera, assistant director of Food and Water Watch, who explains why her group and other organizations oppose the FDA's approval of Aqua Bounty's GMO salmon.
So this would be the first food animal that's going to be allowed on the market that's been genetically engineered. There have been some previous animals, but they weren't things that were destined for our food. So this is a big precedent, and we, lots of groups, including Food and Water Watch, opposed it for a long time. There's a bunch of reasons we're concerned about it. We don't need it. The supposed, you know, benefit from this and why they engineered this salmon is that it's supposed to grow faster in fish farms and get to market size sooner. It's not clear if that's actually going to hold up, but that's what they said. That's, you know, there's a whole conversation there about whether we need to do that or we have other ways we can get people fish as a food. And then we have a lot of questions about what FDA doesn't really know about this thing. So we had a lot of questions and we were concerned about the review process they used, both in terms of whether it's safe to eat and whether it poses risks the environment. And we don't think FDA did a very good job on either of those fronts. And so that's why we were very unhappy to see them approve this.
What's the environmental record of this company that's producing these GMO salmon, Aqua Bounty? I've read some disturbing reports of how they've conducted themselves as a food producing company.
So this is a company that is headquartered in the United States. But when they got approved by the FDA, they put a very specific business plan into the FDA for producing this GMO salmon. And that business plan is that they would raise the eggs, the fish eggs, at a facility in Canada, and then they would raise the fish themselves. They'd take those eggs and they would, you know, grow them out, the full-sized fish, at a facility in Panama, and then they would send just the pieces, you know, they would send the pieces that we were going to eat to the United States. That's what got approved by the FDA. And in looking at the materials and the review process, we do have some concerns about what's been going on with the facilities that the company has run. So there are Canadian environmental groups who are currently suing the Canadian government for their review process of letting that facility in Canada happened in the course of that lawsuit. We've gotten some documents that have been released about problems at that plant, including, you know, outbreak of disease at that plant in Canada that the FDA didn't know about until a bunch of groups like ours, you know, let them know it was in those Canadian documents. And then the Panamanian facility actually got fined by the government there for violations of their environmental rules, and there have been some incidents. There's still a very vague description of what happened. Something went wrong at one point a few years ago, and all of the salmon that they had been growing there, they described as lost, and we still don't have a great handle on what happened there. Probably they just died, but it's not clear. So there's a lot of questions about whether this is a company that is on top of what we need if you're going to do something that's controversial, which is real containment to make sure they don't get out.
What is the first date that these salmon are scheduled to be sold in stores across the country?
We don't have a great answer on that, but it should be a little while. They have to start producing them. They just got permission to do so, you know, a few weeks ago before Thanksgiving. So I've seen different reports, but most reports say it would be many months to well over a year before these would hit the market. One of the problems, though, is that the FDA gave this permission. They said it's legal now to sell this product, but they did not require it to be labeled. They had a choice to do so. That was an option on the table. They laid out conditions for how the company could voluntarily choose to label it, but they didn't require it. And that's going to cause a lot of chaos as people are concerned about this. It's going to cause a lot of confusion. So people probably aren't going to run into it in stores right away, but at some point they could, and we're left kind of having to use other labels to try to figure this out.
What can you tell us about the organizing yours and other groups are doing to try to prevent genetically modified salmon from making its way to food stores across the country and restaurants?
Yeah, so if people are on a list of a group like Food and Water Watch or Friends of the Earth or Center for Food Safety, a lot of groups are working together to try to get more retailers to do this. You know, we spent a lot of years trying to get the FDA not to do this. Unfortunately, they did, and so now we have to deal with that reality. One way to deal with that is to try to get more grocery stores to make a position, you know, to make their company policy that they won't stock this. And so if you are on email lists for groups like ours, you'll be getting notices about ways to get involved with that. If you don't want to wait for that, wherever you go shop, you could find the store manager and tell them, or tell them on their Facebook or on their website, you know, in a comment page, something like that. And then also, you know, we're talking to lots of folks in Congress about what can we do at least to get people some disclosure. And so there's a pretty good debate going on right now, and I think we'll have some opportunities hopefully soon to push at least a discussion in Congress to say, can we get this thing labeled if it's already been approved? And so the senators from Alaska and some of the coastal states are starting to talk to each other to figure out if there's a way to get that done.
That was Patty Lavera, assistant director of the group Food and Water Watch. Learn more about the issues of food safety, genetically engineered products, and food labeling by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
The wages of fear. In the wake of the carnage in Paris and the subsequent events in San Bernardino, California, a wave of fear has swept through France and the U.S. In America, prominent politicians have been trying to outdo each other in the most outrageous fashion, from attacking the families of suspected ISIS people to plans for caging Syrian refugees in internment camps. In a matter of days, American minds have echoed the same xenophobic themes as sent over 100,000 Japanese, mostly Japanese Americans, I might add, to U.S. concentration camps, men, women, and children, back in the 1940s. In the succeeding decades, American presidents have apologized for these injustices, and reparations, albeit modest, have been paid to survivors. But today, the sons and grandsons of those who clamored for Japanese internments now clamor for Syrian and Arab internments, proving the apologies and reparations were but yesterday's crocodile tears, empty as salt water. For politicians exploiting fear are as common as shells along the seashore. They can't help themselves. After over a decade of failed and pointless war, why is there more, not less, fear? What's wrong with this picture? The politicians who are selling the toxin of fear for their own ambitions are leading the nation down the yellow brick road of disaster. No good can come from this. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Sada Shakur. The first time I heard a tape of one of Mumia's radio broadcasts, it was the first time I fully understood why the United States government was so intent on putting him to death. Mumia, the only African political prisoner on death row, didn't use any inflammatory rhetoric. What he said was so clear, so true, that I had to stop everything and concentrate on his message. Mumia Abu-Jamal, journalist, husband, father, he is brilliant. He has the ability to say what needs to be said in the clearest, most vivid way. His language, his strength, and his intelligence remind me of one man, El-Haj Malik Shabazz, otherwise known as Malcolm X. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a man who has truly carried on Malcolm's tradition and the tradition of so many of our freedom fighters who have risked their lives for the freedom of our people. This year, as I celebrated Malcolm's birthday, I couldn't stop thinking about Mumia. I couldn't stop thinking about the man who has spent over 15 years on death row and remains strong, committed, and beautiful. Mumia, political activist, revolutionary, and humanist, has followed faithfully in Malcolm's footsteps. We can feel Malcolm's energy working through Mumia. We can feel Mumia's energy carrying on Malcolm's legacy. If Malcolm X were alive today, I know he would be fighting to save Mumia's life. If Malcolm were alive today, I know he would be fighting to free all political prisoners. In the name of Malcolm X, I make a special appeal to you, sisters and brothers, to fight tooth and nail to save Mumia's life and to free him from the grips of his oppressors. As you honor our forefathers and foremothers, I urge you to honor our living heroes. When you honor the names of Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman, and Malcolm X, I urge you to honor the names of Geronimo Gijaga, Sundiata Okoli, Mutulu Shakur, and Mumia Abu-Jamal. I urge you not to forget and not to betray our living heroes. If we ignore their struggle, we are ignoring our own. If we betray our living history, then we are betraying ourselves. We could not save Malcolm X, but we can save Mumia. We can save him, and we must save him. Because we love our brother, and we need our brother to help us fight for freedom. Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, free all political prisoners. Let us carry on our tradition to freedom.
Not welcome. The image of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump speaks volumes as he calls for a ban on Muslims entering the U.S. The comments flood the globe, the latest expression of American fear, hatred, and stunning ignorance, for it is based on an illusion of American innocence. Many, many Muslims have been in America for centuries. They've been invisible, largely because they already were stigmatized, for they were black. Africans captured from sites in the west coast of Africa, in places like Senegal, they brought these beliefs with them. So it's a little late for a ban. Moreover, this call actually has little to do with Muslim immigrants and everything, with Americans born here, especially white Americans, who are anxious over their falling share of the American demographic and the precipitous growth in brown America. By imagining themselves as Christians instead of what they really are, white nationalists, they position themselves as enemies of Islam and the billions of inhabitants of Muslim states in Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Nor is it coincidence that this is a Republican endeavor, for the party has been racing toward its white self for over half a century, perhaps put best by sociologist Andrew Hacker, who in his 1992 work, Two Nations, Black and White, wrote, "One of the two major parties, the Republicans, has all but explicitly stated that it is willing to have itself regarded as a white party, prepared to represent white Americans and defend their interests." Of course, Republican administrations make sure that they appoint a few black officials, either vocal conservatives or taciturn moderates willing to remain in the background. And they are especially adroit in finding apt candidates for the Supreme Court and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. An unwritten plank in the party strategy is that it can win the offices it wants without black votes. More than that, by sending a message that it neither wants nor needs ballots cast by blacks, it feels it can attract even more votes from a much larger pool of white Americans who want a party willing to represent their racial identity. The words of sociologist Andrew Hacker. Now, some 7 to 8 million Muslim voters needn't worry. Their votes are no longer needed nor wanted by the Republican Party. From imprisoned nations, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Are world leaders gathered in Paris for the UN climate conference sincere in their efforts to turn the tide of climate change, or is there another agenda in play? What are the consequences to humanity not only of climate change, but also of peak oil? Is artificial weather modification taking place, and for what reason? What further signs are there that we have reached the point of no return for preventing climate catastrophe? On this week's Global Research News Hour, as the COP21 Climate Change Conference in Paris, France comes to a close, we probe the multiple related environmental threats political leaders appear not to be confronting. Our guests for the hour are Richard Heinberg of the Post Carbon Institute, Dane Wigington of geoengineeringwatch.org, and Guy McPherson, University of Arizona Professor Emeritus and author of the Nature Bats Last blog. On this week's program, Inconvenient Truths Facing the COP21 Conference, conversations with Richard Heinberg, Dane Wigington, and Guy McPherson. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 11th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Several hours ago, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi reiterated the withdrawal of Turkish troops from Iraq within 24 hours. This follows on from the previous day's demand that Turkey had 48 hours to leave Iraq following its deployment within northern Iraq. Baghdad and the Shiite militias are overstretched, with their fight against ISIS, and they have little presence in this Peshmerga-controlled area. It can only be speculated that Iraq will respond to the Turkish incursions with airstrikes once the 24-hour ultimatum expires. Allegedly, the Turkish troops are there to train Peshmerga forces. That comes from the article, Turkey Given 24 Hours to Withdraw from Iraq, by Al-Masdar News, posted December 8th. The war on terrorism purports to defend the American homeland and protect the civilized world. It is upheld as a war of religion, a clash of civilizations, when in fact the main objective of this war is to secure control and corporate ownership over the region's extensive oil wealth. Throughout history, vilification of the enemy has been applied time and again. Muslims are equated with terrorists. Islamophobia serves to wage nationwide campaigns against Muslims in Europe and North America. It is an instrument of war propaganda used to degrade the history, institutions, values, and social fabric of Muslim countries while upholding the tenets of Western democracy and the free market as the only alternative for these countries. That comes from the article, Why is a Hate Campaign Being Waged Against Muslims? By Michelle Chalsadovsky, posted December 10th. The Russian government has relied on responsible, non-provocative responses. Russia has taken the diplomatic approach by relying on European governments coming to their senses, realizing that their national interests diverge from Washington's, and ceasing to enable Washington's hegemonic policy. Russia's policy has failed. To repeat, Russia's low-key, responsible responses have been used by Washington to paint Russia as a paper tiger that no one needs to fear. We are left with the paradox that Russia's determination to avoid war is leading directly to war. That comes from the article, War is on the Horizon. Is it too late to stop it? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted December 8th, originally appearing at the Paul Craig Roberts Institute of Political Economy website. The FSA and other groups branded as moderates who fight against the authoritarian forces of tyranny, just like a certain Saudi businessman back in the day, function as U.S. proxies in Syria, just like Al-Qaeda did in the heyday of the Soviet-Afghan War. They are dangerously unstable pawns in a global strategy to secure American and Israeli interests in the Middle East, irrespective of the millionfold suffering and uprooting of entire societies caused by their crimes, the majority of which is directed towards other Muslims. Commenting on the Russian military intervention at the invitation of the Syrian government, Mr. Obama said that he had no interest in turning this civil war into a proxy war between Russia and the United States, emphasizing that, quote, this is not some superpower chessboard contest, unquote. But this is exactly what U.S. foreign policy, both Republican and Democrat, has done, starting with the end of the Soviet Union and lasting until this very moment. The only difference now being that the Libya-proven rhetorical strategy of illegal and mandateless intervention via no-fly zones, humanitarianism, and regime change did not have the desired effect in Syria because Iran, Lebanon, and Russia did not abandon their ally. That comes from the article, The Second Cold War, the U.S. Might Come Out on the Losing Side, by Stephen A. Wohl, posted December 8th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. As this installment of the Global Research NewsHour radio program is being prepared for broadcast, 200 governments are deliberating in Paris, France, at the 21st Annual United Nations Conference on Climate Change, or the COP21 conference. The aim, as stated on the conference's website, is to achieve a legally binding and universal agreement on climate with the aim of keeping global warming below 2 degrees Celsius. The analysts featured in this week's program will argue that the COP21 summit will likely not provide a satisfactory response to the forces altering and impacting the future of Earth's environment. To start, we'll hear from a journalist and researcher who has devoted specific attention to the subject of resource depletion, specifically peak oil. Richard Heinberg is a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute and widely regarded as one of the world's foremost peak oil educators. His essays and articles have been published in numerous journals, including Nature, The American Prospect, Public Policy Research, Quarterly Review, and The Ecologist, as well as websites such as Resilience.org, TheOilDrum.com, Alternate.org, ProjectCensored.com, and Counterpunch.com. He's the author of 12 books, including The Party's Over, Oil War and the Fate of Industrial Societies, The Oil Depletion Protocol, A Plan to Avert Oil Wars, Terrorism and Economic Collapse, and his most recent, Afterburn, Society Beyond Fossil Fuels. He's appeared in many film and television documentaries, including Leonardo DiCaprio's 11th Hour. He's the recipient of the M. King Hubbard Award for Excellence in Energy Education, and in 2012 was appointed to His Majesty the King of Bhutan's International Expert Working Group for the New Development Paradigm Initiative. He's also the author of a monthly newsletter, as he calls it, and he joins us now from Santa Rosa, California, to talk about our current energy dilemma in the current context of the current climate talks happening in Paris. So, Richard Heinberg, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Michael. It was quite an introduction. Thanks.
Okay. So, first of all, as I mentioned, you're one of the most foremost educators on the topic of peak oil, and I've read your books that you written earlier. Peak oil, it strikes me, is the opposite end of the fossil fuel energy coin from climate collapse. And you know, just as they say that the goldfish is unaware of the water in which it swims in, my general impression is that 20th century humans are unaware of just how dependent we have become on cheap oil to maintain our current way of life. I'm wondering if it's possible for you to give us maybe a concise overview of that dependence and what peaking oil would therefore mean for the lives and livelihoods of everyday people.
Right. Well, you know, when we discovered fossil fuels a couple of hundred years ago and really started using first coal and then oil and natural gas, it was as though we'd won an energy lottery. Energy is necessary for everything we do, and with abundant, cheap energy in the form of fossil fuels, we were able to do things that we had never imagined before, including making transportation far more available and faster, planes, trains, and automobiles, industrial production. We even transformed our economy during the 20th century to one of what we call consumerism, where the problem early in the 20th century was that with all of this cheap fossil energy, we could make consumer products or manufactured products faster than people were accustomed to wanting or buying them. That led to the problem of overproduction, which in turn led to the Great Depression. So our solutions to that were to stoke more manufacturing and consumption through advertising, talking people into wanting more stuff, and consumer credit, making it easier for people to go into debt to buy more stuff now and pay for it later. So we've created an economy completely unlike anything that existed before, where products are made on one side of the world and shipped to the other, where they're made in much larger quantities, and where we can expect to get in a car or go to an airport and be transported from one place to another at very little cost and in very little time. This is all currently dependent on fossil fuels, and especially oil.
Now, having read the Party's Over and Power Down about a decade ago, I would not have expected to see in the year 2015, years after conventional oil production was expected to peak, that we'd be seeing $40 a barrel oil. And it seems to contradict the standard supply and demand economics. So I'm wondering how you account for that.
Right. It is an interesting historical moment to to be sitting here talking about this. Regular conventional oil production did reach a maximum around 2005 and has stayed on kind of a bumpy plateau since then. What we have seen instead is an increase in unconventional oil production, especially production from the Canadian tar sands and even more so U.S. light tight oil, as it's called, which is produced by hydrofracturing. This is the stuff that's produced in North Dakota, South Texas, and a few other places in the U.S. And that has basically led to almost a doubling of U.S. oil production in the last few years. Now, the characteristics of tight oil production are such that this is oil that's trapped in rocks of very low permeability. So that's why hydrofracturing and horizontal drilling are necessary in order to get the stuff out of the ground. But even so, even with these technologies, the rate of production from a typical well declines very rapidly from the time of drilling until the end of, say, the first year of production. Production has probably fallen by an average of 70%. So that's why it's necessary for the industry to drill so many wells. U.S. tight oil and shale gas drilling in the last few years has led to the drilling of over 80,000 wells in this country. So this is an expensive proposition, and it's depended upon easy money. Very low interest rates and the ability of companies that specialize in this production to convince investors that this is the next big thing. Well, they succeeded in doing that over the last few years, and the incentive then was to go out and drill as much as possible, as quickly as possible, lease as much land as they could and drill it as fast as possible. And this led to overproduction, producing so much oil that it drove down prices below the cost of production. So now currently everyone in the oil patch, especially in the tight oil business, is losing money on every barrel of oil produced. The only producers who can still produce at a profit are ones who are still producing conventional oil from giant oil fields that have been in production for a very long time. So this is leading to a shakeout in the industry. We're going to see over the course of the next few months bankruptcies of many of the smaller companies that have specialized in tight oil. And rates of drilling are already way down. U.S. oil production is headed downward. U.S. natural gas production is headed downward again also. So within the next couple of years, we're going to see some kind of reckoning within the industry. The conventional wisdom is that once the market's balanced out, prices will go back up, rates of drilling will go back up, and production will go back up. But our analysis at Post Carbon Institute suggests this probably isn't true, because even if rates of drilling had remained at levels they were 18 months ago, the geological limits would ensure that tight oil production would peak out in the U.S. before 2020 in any case. And we're bumping up against those limits right now. There are only so many places to drill, and the companies in the fracking fields have preferentially drilled the best sites first. So what's left from now on? There's still a lot of tight oil to be produced, but as time goes on, the more expensive and lower quality sites are basically all that's left.
Yeah, you said a couple of things in there. I mean, you talked about how the depletion rates through these unconventional practices are much more precipitous than what you'd find with conventional production. And I'm just wondering if that or any of the other, maybe the way we go about estimating the oil reserves and, of course, the geological limits, which in financial terms would probably impose some extra cost in terms of recovery, cleanup, and so on. So I guess I'm wondering, is there potentially some kind of a bubble that might come as a result of taking these new methods and, you know, just sort of conflating them into traditional ways that we assess the you know, standard oil production and oil prices?
Right. Well, this has been a bubble. It's been a classic bubble. It's been fueled by cheap money and by over enthusiasm over the over the prospects of these resources, and the bubble is bursting. Just one of the companies, Chesapeake Energy, which has specialized in fracking technology, particularly with shale gas, but also some tight oil, has now announced that they're being forced to write down about 40% of the reserves that they hold, because they know that these reserves can't be produced at current prices. The Securities and Exchange Commission requires them to list their reserves according to what can realistically be produced at current market values. So as more and more companies are forced to do this over the next few weeks, we're going to see the paper reserves of tight oil in the U.S. decline probably by something like 30 to 35%. That's, you know, barrels of oil, millions of barrels of oil that everyone's currently assuming to exist are basically going to go up in smoke.
Okay, now, so going back to the COP summit, now, as I mentioned earlier, peak oil would appear to be the opposite side of the fossil fuel energy coin from climate change, and you'd think the two would kind of go together like peanut butter and jelly, and yet I don't see much messaging about peak oil on this agenda or any other higher-level conference. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I've heard it speculated that world leaders understand that their dependence on depleting non-renewable energy resources is, you know, inherently not just risky, but it's a crisis waiting to happen as this century wears on. And appealing to the necessity of changing energy resources due to climate change gives them a way of dealing with the energy transition in a way that's perhaps a little less alarmist and unpalatable. I don't know if that's really true, but the fact is, you know, this energy transition away from our reliance on fossil fuels is necessary and inevitable no matter how you look at it, whether it's from the standpoint of depletion or the standpoint of pollution. We've gotten ourselves into an addiction to resources that are killing us now and that are going to become more scarce as time goes on anyway. So, you know, we've got to kick the habit.
Mm. And, well, in terms of kicking the habit, it just seems as if what's come up through so far with the COP summit, there's been discussion of carbon pricing and carbon taxes and carbon credits, cap and trade, and this sort of thing. I'm wondering if what you're seeing or witnessing at the COP summit, do you feel that there is a sincere attempt here to grapple with the climate change dilemma, or is this possibly a cover for maybe a more cynical money-making enterprise, or maybe it's both? I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Oh, I'm sure both are going on. Certainly there is a sincere attempt by very many people at the COP21, both government ministers and general public, nonprofit environmental organizations who are there. Everyone wants to deal with this problem. But there's a sort of catch-22. If we reduce our carbon emissions fast enough to actually avert catastrophic climate change, then what we also do at the same time is reduce the amount of energy available to society, and therefore we undercut economic growth and actually risk economic contraction. And nobody in government wants to even imagine a world without economic growth. So that puts them in a bind. You know, do they make commitments that will save the world from climate chaos and risk economic contraction, or do they make, you know, smaller sort of token nods to emissions reductions and put the world on a path toward rising sea levels and all the rest?
Now, I know that among the standard environmental NGOs like 350.org, they're talking about the demand to leave 80% of fossil fuel energy reserves in the ground, but also switch over to a 100% renewable energy economy. And I'm wondering, you know, in light of what you just said, if these initiatives are politically achievable, or for that matter, in the case of a renewable energy economy, if it's even physically achievable, given the kind of civilization we've become used to.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there are a number of proposals on the table for a transition to 100% renewable energy economy. And there are a number of people who are selling this as being quickly and easily achievable with no economic pain. We've done some analysis at Post Carbon Institute on the renewable energy transition. We're actually preparing a book on the subject right now. And our conclusion is that it is going to be very costly. We've built our current infrastructure around the qualities of our current energy sources. And so it's not just going to be a matter of building millions and millions of solar panels and wind turbines and continuing as we are. Those produce electricity, and only about 20% of global final energy is consumed as electricity. So with all of the rest of our energy usage in transportation and agriculture and manufacturing, massive adaptations will be required either to electrify our energy use or to change industrial processes, really, in some cases, quite profoundly, especially in making cement, for example, or to change technologies, as in transportation. Everyone thinks of electric cars right away, but trucking is going to be much more difficult, shipping is going to be much more difficult, and aviation is almost a non-starter in a renewable energy world. So the adaptation is going to be profoundly challenging for especially the industrialized world.
Yes, globalization, global trade is pretty much inconsistent with a serious strategy for coping with peak oil and mitigating climate change.
Right. I mean, we could put sails on existing container ships and make them much more energy efficient, but they'd still have to use bunker oil. And if we were to transition to all sailing ship transport, the fact is, realistically, we'd be transporting a lot less stuff and a lot fewer people.
Mm. So I guess finally then I just wanted to ask what your suggestions would be for the wider public on how to confront these twin challenges of peak oil and climate change, and what your vision of a post-carbon world would look like.
Right. Well, I think we do have to put political pressure on our leaders to make the difficult choice and promote a more rapid shift away from fossil fuels. But, you know, realistically, I think we have to start looking at our own lives as well and thinking about how to reduce our energy use in all of its different forms, not just electricity, but also in transportation and heating, home heating, and so on. Because we're all going to be faced with the requirement to do that one way or another over the next few years, no matter how this goes. So getting there ahead of the crowd, there will definitely be some advantages there. What will the future fossil fuel-free world look like? Well, you know, inevitably it's going to be a world in which we have less energy and in which we're less mobile. So if we start thinking about that now and imagining ways to maintain the best of human values and of what makes life worth living, then I think we can make the transition in a much better way. Right now, unfortunately, most of what people think of when they think of a better life is more consumption, you know, faster pace, more mobility, and all of that. But you know, that's in the long run, that's not what really makes life satisfying for us. And if we get back to our deeper human values of community and family and connection with the natural world, I think we stand a much better chance of making it through this transition as functional societies.
Richard Heinberg, thank you very much for sharing those perspectives with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Heinberg is a senior fellow of the Post-Carbon Institute. He's an author and has appeared in numerous film and television documentaries. You could read more of his writings on the website richardheinberg.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We're joined now by Dane Wigington. He has an extensive background in the field of solar energy and is a licensed contractor, a former employee of Bechtel. He is the founder of the information site geoengineeringwatch.org and is convinced that geoengineering is not only the number one threat facing humanity at the present time, but is actually underway. So, Dane Wigington, welcome back to the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you, Michael. And in regard to the threat, again, the way I've always framed that is it's the greatest and most immediate threat short of nuclear cataclysm, which, of course, could happen any time as well. But, again, short of that, mathematically speaking, the amount of cataclysms, contamination, atmospheric destruction that we see from climate engineering would certainly fit that statement.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. Now, it has been a while since we last spoke to you. I wonder if maybe you could just give a kind of a concise review of some of the impacts that you're seeing from the geoengineering efforts that you allege are taking place.
Well, again, we don't allege that. And when we have, for example, 750-page congressional documents that we've recently found and posted outlining the full scope and scale of the programs even decades ago and giving the historical summary of these programs going back 30 years prior to that even, we encourage people to review these documents because it's quite clear on them these programs have been going on globally for perhaps 70 years. So we have the lab tests to back up the materials that are raining down on us around the globe, match the climate engineering patents exactly, and when we have film footage of the aircraft actually spraying at altitude, turning on and off, nozzles visible. We have up-close photographs of those nozzles mounted on the pylons directly behind the engine exhaust stream. People can review those photos. Again, we have so much documentation that really proves conclusively these programs are going on. And people ask why, Michael. They always ask why. But ultimately, to try to control the weather is about power and control. And when they ask who's doing this, again, all roads lead eventually back to the central bankers who control militaries, who control economies. You know that. So, again, these are programs that have done immense damage to the climate system. I'm not saying it's the only source of damage by any means, but the damage is cataclysmic at this point, and the only thing the military-industrial complex seems to know how to do is to double down. The more damage that's done, the more they ramp up these programs. So we're seeing absolutely catastrophic effects from totally disrupted hydrological cycle, shredded ozone layer. We have a contamination of the entire surface of the Earth, And there's downstream effects with the shredded ozone, more UV radiation that's killing plankton, that's contributing to ocean die-off, on the forests burning down around the globe, again, disrupted rain cycle. Bioavailable metals are killing the root systems, and we have the same metals are incendiaries when they coat the foliage. We have more lightning because the atmosphere is more conductive. We have human health issues. We're seeing everything we would expect to see from these programs, this massive contamination of these toxic metals used in the programs. We're seeing everything, and then including down right down to the bees, Michael. I'm not sure if you might have seen everybody. Most people know the bees are collapsing, and we now have peer-reviewed study to say conclusively the bees are packed full of the same metals that are shown in geoengineering patents that are showing up in our test, aluminum being a primary one. So from every direction, we see red flags going up that show that these programs are cataclysmic.
Yes, I've definitely effectively connected the dots there. I just want to stay with this whole issue of the why, the motive behind it. And I guess, I mean, maybe I'm if this is the right projection, I mean, we've gone to from chemical weapons to nuclear weapons, and then the weather modification is that kind of like the next frontier of control, or do you see other sorts of motives on the horizon there?
Well, I think it's inarguable that being able to control the climate is really the ultimate covert weapon. A country can win a war without anyone necessarily knowing there was a war going on. And we see this again over and over and over in previous decades. Countries that have been, for example, droughted into total collapse, starting with sub-Saharan African countries that then allow U.S. occupation, sometimes that begins under, quote, humanitarian pretext. And we know the drought-causing effects of the aerosolization of the atmosphere, the introduction of tiny particulates which cause too many condensation nuclei. It disperses, distributes precipitation, diminishes it, disrupts evaporation. We have scientific figures to back this up. For example, global dimming, which is the term that refers to how much of the sun's direct energy is no longer reaching the surface of the planet as compared to 5 decades ago, it's now 20 to 30%. That's massive. It takes an unbelievable amount of materials to do that. And yes, pollution is a part of that, but climate engineering is a bigger part, and that's the stated goal of geoengineering programs like solar radiation management, to fill the atmosphere with particulates to block the sun. So, and using it as a weapon, how many countries do we see that were the targets of U.S. foreign policy, like the recent Middle Eastern countries, every single one of which was subjected to record drought prior to the destabilization and occupation? And we have leaders of these countries, Michael, on the floor of the UN stating, and this has been publicized, some of these leaders, starting with Iran, that their countries were the target of NATO weather modification programs. So, again, we have so much information if people would simply examine it. And now we have the U.S. population that clearly, whatever we want to decide the motive is also being affected horrifically by these programs. And I was in the lieutenant governor's office in California, Gavin Newsom, with his aides, and presented data 2 years ago stating that this drought would continue and worsen if these programs continued. It can't not happen because we have satellite imagery of them spraying off the coast in the storm track. That's exactly what has happened. We know people in the state know this is going on. We know agencies know what's going on, but everybody's afraid to speak out, Michael. So In the meantime, we're all targeted ultimately by these programs.
I think that there's a tendency among the wider public to question, well, you know, somebody would have spoken out about it. But, you know, I think a lot of people are aware the Manhattan Project was originally top secret, as well as the U-2 bomber. Are we talking about a kind of Manhattan Project for the climate here, something that's been kept top secret and there may be proceeding with these things and keeping it out of the official messaging to the wider public? Is that what we're dealing with here?
No question. And we have some huge red flags in that arena, too. One, we know the Obama administration has prosecuted more whistleblowers than all other administrations combined. Two, we know that the agreements of confidentiality signed by people in the military are enforced with extreme mechanisms, and in some cases, we have indirect communication with those that worked on some of the aerosol spraying mechanisms that have stated they signed agreements that contain provision for lethal enforcement. Now, aside from that which we can't verify, we do know this. We have a recent gag order on all National Weather Service and all NOAA employees, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Why in the world would you need to gag the meteorologists? Because they all know this is going on, too. I've spoken to a NOAA scientist face-to-face who admitted that to me. So the bottom line is we have a very big elephant in the room that's decimating the Earth's life support systems, decimating our health, every single one of us. And those who don't believe this, it doesn't really matter because it's not going to change the reality. We are all sucking in what they're spraying with every breath. It's building up on our systems, showing up everywhere we would expect it to. Alzheimer's, dementia stats going through the roof, autism stats going through the roof. We see MIT has now stated on the record that on the current trajectory, in less than 10 years, every other child will have autism. What's it take to wake people up? I don't know.
Okay. Now, there's something else I wanted to I saw something on your site where you were at a traditional climate march, and it reminded me that it seems as if there's like two camps. There's the geoengineering watchdogs like yourself, and then there's the traditional, carbon dioxide is the main driver of climate change. And I see you as being part of both camps. Like, you don't dismiss carbon as a driver of climate change, but at the same time, you are clearly very much an advocate of, or not advocate, but acknowledging the reality of geoengineering. And I'm finding that you've got, those two camps tend not to overlap very often. And I was wondering if you have an explanation or what your understanding would be of why it seems so difficult to sort of cross that divide.
Well, unfortunately, we have a society that thinks dichotomously. Everything's either this or that, and that's just not reality. Our situation is much more complex. It's not just this or that. It's this and that and a whole lot of other things. So, yes, CO2 is certainly a problem, and those who say it's not are certainly not living in, for example, the ocean, where the oceans are acidifying so quickly that we have that contributing to massive marine die-off. We have plants are not absorbing CO2 the way that it was projected because too much is also a problem. CO2 is certainly necessary, but again, water is necessary. If you're 10 feet under, not so much. So we also have, on the other side of the coin, we have those in the anti-geoengineering camp that want to pretend that there's no damage to the planet by the human race except for geoengineering, and that's, of course, not true either. I hope that from both sides of the fence, people realize the equation is complex. The denial on the environmentalist global warming side is the denial of climate engineering is truly astounding. It's absolutely astounding. When we have the single greatest climate disrupting factor of all, climate engineering, completely ignored by the environmentalist camp, it's inexcusable. It's hypocrisy that absolutely boggles the mind, Michael. So I hope that, and I know a lot of these, I know scientists in that camp as well, so I hope that they find some courage and face the fact that the greatest threat of all, even greater than any of the other forms of human damage to the planet right now, the greatest threat of all is climate engineering. We have to face that. And I hope people from both sides of that fence realize the equation is more complex than either one of them would like to make it. And I hope we build some bridges instead of burning them.
Which brings us to the COP21 climate conference happening in Paris. Your comments suggest that political leaders really know a lot more than they're letting on, I think. So what then is your take on the purpose of these talks if they're not really like where, geoengineering isn't even on the radar screen apparently? So what do you think is going on there?
It's certainly not on the public radar screen, but it's certainly the main topic of discussion behind the scenes. And again, I believe, and we'll find out in the next few days, Michael, but that this is just one more big dog and pony show, just like the Copenhagen conference, just like the Cancun conference, and that the real agenda is to climate engineer, to continue that, to force countries to comply. And we see after the previous two climate conferences in Copenhagen and Cancun, we had record low temperatures at those conferences at the time of the conference, in spite of warmer than normal temperatures in the surrounding areas. How does that happen? That's a demonstration of what climate engineering can do with chemical ice nucleation, jet stream manipulation. So that was perhaps a demonstration to those countries there that this is what their quote-unquote cure is, even though we know from all available data this is not only is it not a cure, it's a curse worse than any of the problems it claims to mitigate. So I believe what we'll see from Paris is nothing definitive for any type of carbon cutting. Nobody intends to carbon cut. Nobody intends to stop looting, pillaging, plundering the planet. They just want to ramp up the climate engineering even more. So As a priority issue, and this is not a job I wanted, I'm not an activist, not politically oriented, but quite simply, when Earth's life support systems are being torn apart intentionally with climate engineering, which really comes down to power and control, we don't stop that. It's game over. So I hope people take a good hard look at their priorities. If we can't walk out the door and breathe without sucking this stuff in, we all have a problem. And again, the sort of distractions that we see, which Paris is one of them, the front and center topic of conversation should be, must be, climate engineering. It's going to take all of us to bring it to that point. We all need to work together. Any one of us could be the pebble that starts the landslide of awareness. We don't sell anything at geoengineeringwatch.org. We're non-political. There's links there that you can send out to organizations that are carry informational data with them, introduction letters. You can help start spot fires of awareness by simply passing on credible data to people who would care if they only knew. And we need everyone to help us in that effort.
Dane Wigington, founder of the information site geoengineeringwatch.org. Thank you again, Dane.
Thank you, Michael.
Joining us now is Guy McPherson. He's an emeritus professor of natural resources and the environment at the University of Arizona. He's the author of about a dozen books, including Going Dark and The Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, which was co-authored by Carolyn Baker. He's the author of the Nature Bats Last blog at www.guymcpherson.com. The blog includes a regularly updated monster climate change essay, which documents all the available scientific literature on climate change. And he believes the science pretty much proves that there is not much we can do to avert climate catastrophe other than prepare for our inevitable extinction as a species. So, Guy McPherson, thanks once again for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
We were having this conversation in the context of the ongoing COP21 summit, the Conference of the Parties, taking place in Paris. I wanted maybe just to give a bit of an overview, first of all, if you might be willing to address a couple of points with regard to the futility of any attempt to mitigate climate change. You've spoken, for example, about so-called positive feedback loops. In other words, the warmer it gets, the more you unleash mechanisms that guarantee further warming. Maybe you could just present us maybe with an update or two in terms of examples of that phenomenon which seems to be sealing our fate.
Yeah, and one of those was just acknowledged by Chris Mooney at the Washington Post. He's been writing some great stuff lately, and his article yesterday is titled "How the Earth Itself Could Undermine a Paris Climate Agreement." And he's talking about clath rates underneath the relatively shallow seabed of the Arctic Ocean. And so he's talking about the Earth itself sort of taking control or taking command of the situation as opposed to anything humans do at this point. And he says could, but I think we're beyond could and into the realm of is happening already. And so that's just one of the, at this point, many self-reinforcing feedback loops that that threaten our own species with its persistence, as well as many other species, that it appears we have entered the realm of abrupt climate change. Similar to what happened some 55 million years ago when the Earth warmed by 5°C in about 13 years.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's the issue of being, documented in the literature in the midst of a rate of species extinction that equates with the great extinctions of old.
That's right. We are, the great dying from some 252 million years ago. Proceeded much, much, much more slowly than what we're seeing today, orders of magnitude more slowly than the current rate of climate change. So it's pretty clear that we're in the midst of a profound existential crisis for the continuation of our species, not to mention the many, many, many other species that are being driven to extinction by some aspect of industrial civilization.
Now, I don't know how closely you've been monitoring the COP conference, but I think we've mentioned before is a reluctance, even in the referee journal literature, to acknowledge methane as a driver of climate change. And I'm wondering if you've seen any evidence of progress in that regard. Are they at least beginning to acknowledge methane as a significant threat?
They are. At the COP21 meetings in Paris, going on right now, there's finally been the admission that methane represents a serious threat, but they downplay the likelihood of it becoming a threat in the near term. It's, as always, a problem for the grandchildren to solve, not a predicament that is already underway.
Yeah, that does seem to be a bit contradictory. If you acknowledge it, but it's not a threat.
Yeah, and you know, that's not all that surprising. We are complex enough organisms that we are capable of both admitting something is happening and denying that it will have any impact on us. And you know, humans do that on a pretty regular basis. Our cognitive dissonance is pretty profound. So it shouldn't be a big surprise that when we get together in groups, we can do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you've said that civilization itself is a problem. I mean, you've called it a heat engine. But at the same time, civilization is generating global dimming. So we have a real predicament in the sense that even if we were to somehow collapse civilization, we bring the problem of global warming on us even more. It becomes escalated.
That's right. And it took me a while to really start paying attention to global dimming, even though a paper by James Hansen and colleagues brought it to the refereed journal attention, the scientific community's attention, in late 2011. And it seems that paper indicating a 1.2 plus or minus 0.2 degrees Celsius temperature rise when global dimming stopped, it seems that was quite conservative. So we are in this predicament. We're damned if we do and damned if we don't. Tim Garrett's extensive work indicates that civilization is a heat engine, regardless of how civilization is powered, whether it's through fossil fuels or wind turbines and solar panels and so forth.
I take it you're not a big believer in what's being called transitioning to the renewable economy.
Well, no, which is interesting because, you know, that's what I did here in establishing this homestead, but that was quite a long time ago now. I committed to this place in 2007 and started working here full-time in early 2009. And so, yeah, I have a 3.15 kilowatt solar array on the straw bale duplex that my wife and I share with another small family. But it's when you look at this scale of the predicament and look at the referee journal literature that has appeared since 2007 and since 2009, now we know. Now we know that civilization itself is a heat engine, that keeping the game of cards, that the house of cards intact by other means besides fossil fuels is just continuing to promote and exacerbate the sixth mass extinction on Earth, as well as all the other untoward aspects of civilization, disparity in wealth or in created poverty, accelerated erosion rates, fouling the air, dirtying the water, and on the list goes.
Okay, so. Another point I wanted to bring up with you that's been kind of prominent in these talks is the this idea of this threshold of 2 degrees Celsius above baseline, the pre-industrial levels, is the absolute limit. I mean, I've heard that the scientific accepted standard is 1.5 degrees Celsius above baseline, and I don't know, what is your understanding of the actual threshold as far as your research has revealed?
Climate writer David Spratt pointed out in a video from October 2014 that half a degree Celsius was a reasonable target. And I think that's probably right, that that was a reasonable target. You know, as described by the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases in October of 1990, now more than 25 years ago, quote, beyond 1 degree C may elicit rapid, unpredictable, and nonlinear responses that could lead to extensive ecosystem damage. So we've known for 25 years that 1 degree C was the absolute upper limit. It seems that we triggered a bunch of self-reinforcing feedback loops at about a half a degree. Half a degree C, about halfway to that absolute upper limit pointed out by the United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases. And so it's this notion that there's a political target of 2 degrees C is not matched by any scientific evidence. It certainly isn't a scientific target, and it hasn't been for a really, really long time. Even James Hansen, in January 2011, in an interview with The Independent, says 2 degrees Celsius is guaranteed disaster, and he gave up on the 2C target not long after that and said 1C is the absolute limit. Well, it's pretty apparent we've exceeded the 1C as well. If you look at the global average temperature for the last 10 years, we are beyond 1 degree Celsius. And if you look more recently, 2014, the record-setting year, and 2015, which is 99% certain to be much higher global average temperature than occurred in 2014. Well, 1 degree C is a long way behind us, and that was the absolute upper limit pointed out by the conservative United Nations Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases more than 25 years ago.
So, Guy, do you have any explanation or hypothesis for why it is that we have so many prominent climate activists and people who are don't seem to be addressing these the research that you're pointing to? I mean, is there some sort of a cognitive dissonance, or might there be some sort of a more, I don't know, sinister agenda that keeps them focusing on this, we got to do something or it's all over, and you keep saying that over and over again, expecting different results?
Well, I think there's several factors going on here. One, there's this culture, and this culture promotes the idea. I would say not even overtly as much as it does implicitly that civilization is the only way to live, when in fact anybody who's looked at the evidence dating back more than a few thousand years knows better than that. And anybody who looks at the evidence for current tribal situations or bands of people who are living outside of civilization. So that's one thing. We tend to believe what this culture screams in our ear every day from birth, that this is the only way to live. In addition, there are people who are paid to deny the ongoing evidence. This from 2 days ago in The Guardian. Quote, an undercover sting by Greenpeace has revealed that two prominent climate skeptics were available for hire by the hour to write reports casting doubt on the dangers posed by global warming. And the professors in question in this case are William Happer, the Cyrus Fogg Brackett Professor of Physics at Princeton University, and Frank Clemente, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Penn State University. These are big-time universities, and they have professors working for them who will write reports paid by the hour to question whether there's such a thing as anthropogenic climate change. So there's a culture, there's the paid professors who will report anything for a sufficient price, and then, of course, there's ExxonMobil recently caught out having known about anthropogenic climate change as a result of burning fossil fuels since the late 1970s, and denying that information in a manner similar to the tobacco industry knowing about the hazards of smoking to personal health and still not revealing that information. So there's a bunch of little bits of evidence indicating that people have known for a long time, that we have, as a culture, have known for a long time what's happening. And yet, we as individuals experience cognitive dissonance. A great book that came out within the last couple of years that I haven't read, I just love it based on the title, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And it's about cognitive dissonance, and that's all you really need to know, is that we all think that it's other people who are making the mistakes, not me. And so that's obviously a significant driver behind this whole process as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Guy McPherson, I certainly enjoy, if that's the word for it, having these sorts of conversations with you, because they end up being a real kind of a chiropractic adjustment for the brain in terms of confronting an international news story that's just not getting an accurate presentation. Guy, I'll let you get back to your work out there at the homestead, and thank you once again for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you, Michael. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Guy McPherson is Emeritus Professor of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona, the author of over a dozen books, including his most recent Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind. And you can find his blog and the Monster Climate Change essay full of references at the website www.guymcpherson.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.